can hold my breath for a minute or so. 5 days without food is as long as I'll go. I didn't sleep once for 4 days and 3 nights. I once didn't stop for 7 red lights. I jumped into water that's 50 degrees. I rode in a kayak in 30-foot seas. Stayed in the woods for a week with a knife. A flint when I lost it nearly cost me my life. 20 years later, I'm still upside down.
It's a small, it's a small world. The morning has passed,
turned upside down.
It's a short road, but the mountains are turned upside down.
It's a small world,
but we all start out small.
I hold through air, though I feel I'm alone. I stick with the others to the skin of the stone. Stop for a stranger just to give him a lift. Like a lizard to the side of a cliff. I treat every minute like an hour and then it feels like a year has just flashed by again. We build a foundation, but where do we stand when all air is water and all water is land? 20 years later, I'm still upside down.
It's a small world, but this journey will turn upside down.
Everybody, we're live. I survived the bitter blast, and now I believe we're on to the, I don't know, Blue Mountain Freeze.
Are these coffee flavors?
No.
What are we talking about?
This is the names that the local weather station that plays in my coffee shop that I see many mornings gives to weather for the week. So this past week it was cold. It got very cold. It is January. That happens. And that was apparently the bitter blast. Like, were weather events as heavily branded in the past as they are now?
I don't know, but now that you've opened this can of worms, buckle up, because I have thoughts about weather right now. So if to recap, and I've been through this many times, Virginia or Richmond, anyway, I shouldn't generalize to Virginia. Richmond, if we get like 3 inches of snow in a day or so, the kids will be out of school for probably a day, right? So if they know that 3 inches is due on a Tuesday, they'll be out that Tuesday. 6+ inches of snow, you're looking at multiple days off of school, generally speaking, like anywhere between 2 and 5 days off of school, right? As I sit here now on Wednesday evening, we are slated for 3 inches of snow on Saturday, which is, manageable for us, but a little aggressive. On Sunday, we're due for 24 inches. In total, that is 30 inches of snow, which I don't even know. I think it's like 3/4 of a meter or something like that. It's ridiculous how much snow we're going to be. Yeah, it's about 3/4 of a meter of snow. And
that,
like I said,
is
to you,
something.
That's not good. I said to Aaron just yesterday, what's about to happen is that we're going to get the COVID we thought we were getting in 2020, where we don't leave the house for 2 weeks and then we'll leave again.
Because
we will be utterly screwed if Richmond gets damn near a meter of snow, and it's going to be awful. But no, I haven't heard any branding for the snow that we're getting, to come back to your actual point. It hasn't been branded, but we are going to be getting so much snow. And I was out running errands earlier today, and everyone is driving like idiots because they're all trying to go to the grocery store and buy all the things. Aaron went to Costco during the like fancy lad hours, or fancy lass in her case hours, I think it's the executive membership, which is not that much money at all. You can go an hour earlier than the plebes, and she was there this morning. Yeah, and the store hadn't officially opened for the regular folks, and she said the line was all the way to the back of the store to check out. Like, it's ridiculous.
That makes sense. Like, for a place like that doesn't really have snow infrastructure, to be facing a giant storm, like, that is actually expected behavior and not that unreasonable.
I mean, this would all happen if we were getting just the 3 inches of snow, but the 24 we're currently slated for, that will ruin Richmond for at least a week, probably the better part of 2 weeks. Now, that being said, oftentimes, like when it gets close, it'll peter out and decide, oh, actually, I'm going to take a turn to the north or the south, or, something will happen on the way. But yeah, I'm screwed. I am legitimately lightly concerned about my presence on the podcast, not obviously tonight, but a week from tonight, because who knows? We may not have power for a week or so. I don't know. It's going to be great.
Jeez. Yeah. Oh, by the way. So first of all, yes, good luck, everybody, getting through that. That could be quite something for a lot of our listeners. Totally separately, not even close to related. You mentioned like she went during like the plebeian hours or whatever.
That was before the plebeian hours.
Right.
She was there.
Anyway, I just watched. I just finished Pluribus on Apple TV. It's really
I haven't
good.
Seen it yet.
I'm not going to say anything about it, except I really enjoyed it and I can recommend it.
Oh, good deal.
The less you know, the
Maybe
better.
You watch a modern TV show.
I know. I'm feeling behind now. Aaron and I are cruising through the pit, which I like quite a lot. We're like 3/4 of the way through season one. But look at you go. Very well done.
Thank you.
Speaking of TV-related things, I would like to briefly, John Siracusa, briefly address the elephant in the room. And maybe Marco can insert taps in the edit right here, because apparently your beloved Sony TVs, no more, my friend, or at least not in the way they used to be.
Hello, future Marco. Was the snow stuff the pre-show, or is this the pre-show?
The snow stuff was the pre-show.
All right. Well, now,
instead of doing TV stuff, I have to remind Casey.
Oh, my God.
Go back and do the member special. Just leave your intro was perfectly good, Casey. I'm going to pick up right where you left off there, but we do have to talk about the member special first. So please do that.
In my defense, first of all, thank you, John.
In your defense, it's only pink with a yellow background.
No. I genuinely thought we were still in part of the pre-show. That's my apology.
How much pre-show do you think there is?
All right. I mean, I'm not saying I shouldn't have known.
Maybe I can make it blink.
Oh, Jesus, John. This one was a deliberate... That was the wrong choice, but it was a deliberate choice, okay, as compared all right. to all the other times where it was accidental.
All right. Well, anyway, all right, so rewind and reset.
Okay, so the plan is that you are going to pick up...
Yeah, so I'm going right to... Your intro to the TV thing was perfectly good. I can pick up directly from there, but we do need to do the membership.
All right, so I will leave a beat deliberately in awkward silence after we finish the member special stuff, and that'll be your cue to just jump
right
in. Okay, here we go. Goodbye, Future Marco.
Bye.
So before we continue, we should talk to you and announce that there is a new member special, and we went back to our favorite trough. We went to the HP tier list, and now we're doing, this time we did automotive logos. So the tier lists, I think, are certainly most listeners' favorite member special, and honestly, I think they're kind of mine too. And so this time we talked about various automotive logos, and John put together the list of logos. He very clearly announced on the episode that he did not do all of them. He's well aware of it. You can see some of John's preferences and the choices he made, but I still think it was a very, very fun episode, and you should check it out. So, John, if you've never heard any of our member specials, how could you hear only the most recent one or maybe older ones?
You just join to become a member. Go to adp.fm/join and become a member. Get access to all of the member specials. You can just download them all because you're a computer nerd and then unsubscribe and listen to them at your leisure, or you can just stay subscribed and listen to them as they come out. We have a lot of tier list episodes, as Casey mentioned. This is probably the biggest one we've ever done in terms of the number of little tiles that we dragged up into the tier list. And yet, there are just so many possible logos, especially since we did historical ones. I tried to pick ones that I found interesting, acknowledging that there are many that I missed. The only one that I regret that I missed. I regret when people are like, people are enthusiastic about tier lists, like, oh boy, automotive logos. I can't wait to hear about the logo from this company. And I know before they even started listening that we didn't do that company at all. There's just too many of them. But the one I regret not including is Kia, because they really messed up their logo and I would have loved to trash them.
I think we would have, that would have been the fight. That would have been the biggest fight.
You think they actually improved the Kia logo? Anyway,
I don't remember the history, but
Kia
like
is not, Kia is not in this episode, but there are 91 other logos. We may do another automotive logo one some point in the future. No promises. Some people are asking us to do European car brands that we have never heard of, which might be fun. But anyway, we've got this one, automotive logos, 91 in total, put into a tier list. We were ruthlessly efficient, and we got the job done in record time.
Yeah, you know, this is my brave, bold stance and my hot take. The current Kia logo, I think it's good. I like it.
Whoa.
Nope, it's very bad.
All right.
I will also say, like,
that...
Yeah, I will also say, John did an incredible amount of work to prepare for this.
That is true.
Mm-hmm. The number of logos was very high. The number of images he had to find and generate was very high. Like,
and try to justify with varying degrees of success.
Yeah, like it. This was quite.
The research was difficult. Let's just say.
Oh my! I mean, it took me hours to do the editing of just like inserting all the images and processing them that he had already generated. Like, I had a fraction of the work. He must have had so much more. So thank you, John, for probably working on this for like at least 2 straight days of work.
Yep, it was a lot. So we appreciate you, John. Thank you. hp.fm/join.
All right. So we're not going to talk about the TCL Sony thing this week. I know it's a big news story. People want to hear what I have to say about that. We will talk about it next week. It is not particularly time sensitive, I think, since nothing's really happening until like 2027, and more news about it is breaking as we speak. So I think they'll actually be, we'll do a better job of it next week. So there's that. But before we do that, my original plan was to give a brief mention here to John Gruber's article in which he links to the Sony TCL story and says at the end that Sony TVs haven't been the Sony TVs of yore for a very long time. Basically saying, sad to see these news, but you know, Sony hasn't been that great in the TV business recently anyway. And I was incensed by this. It's totally wrong. I demanded he publish a retraction, and I was going to rant about it on the show. But in between the time that I did that and then sat down to record, he's published a retraction. So suffice it to say, Sony has been at the top of the best possible picture quality TV market for the past several years. And that's why I'm interested in them. And that's why lots of people are interested in this story. And Gruber was not aware of that because he's just been using his LG TV and doesn't care as much about picture quality. I don't know. Anyway, he's retracted it. Problem solved. Tune in next week for more on the TCL Sony story.
Quote Gruber, John Syracuse tells me I need to run a retraction. He even used an exclamation mark.
I did in my private message to him. In my public one, I did not use an exclamation mark.
Oh, man, that's incredible. All right, I wanted to call Marco's attention to something. Marco, I don't know if you even know where your Vision Pro is, but you might have to charge it because coming, coming sometime at the end of the month is a two-part, I believe, documentary coming on January 30th is a two-part docuseries called Top Dogs, which goes deep in behind the scenes in the, was it Greenwich Dog Show? Some dog show that's not on this continent. I think it's like Westminster right over there.
The big one?
Is that the one?
Connecticut is on this continent.
No, I thought.
There was probably a Greenwich over there first, though,
if I
had to guess.
Yes, there is. That's where Greenwich Mean Time comes from.
Where the mean time is.
Exactly.
It's so mean.
It's so nasty that time. I mean, it's not the one true time zone, am I right? Ding. Anyways, the point is, Marco, you might have to charge your Vision Pro and watch this docuseries on January 30th, which looks extremely cute if you're a dog person.
All right. Got to give them credit. They will probably get me to do that, yes.
That's what I thought.
Point of order, this should have been in Vision Pro Corner in the topic section. Moving on.
Wow.
Do we have a Vision Pro Corner in
we
the
do.
Topics
You
right
made
now?
It. You invented it.
Yeah, but then it went away. We
I know,
ran
but you
out
can bring it back at any
about.
Time you want. It's just not really follow-up.
Sorry, Dad. All right. Cloud technology has been mentioned in Apple and Google's joint statement. Reading from Google's blog, the next generation of Apple Foundation models will be based on Google's Gemini models and cloud technology.
According we talked about this last week, and I highlighted the cloud technology, which, again, Manton Reese pointed out. Of like, what do they mean by cloud technology? We know they're using the models, but what's the cloud thing? Well, Gurman has an answer this week.
Right. So Gurman writes, in a potential juicy... reboot that whole thing. Hello and goodbye, future Marco.
Bye.
Right. So Gurman writes, in a potential policy shift for Apple, the two partners are discussing hosting the chatbot capabilities of Siri directly on Google servers running powerful chips known as TPUs, or Tensor Processing Units. The previously promised non-chatbot update to Siri, retaining the current interface, is planned for iOS 26.4. The chatbot capabilities will likely come in June at Apple's Worldwide Developers Conference.
Hmm. Yeah, so Gurman is essentially confirming what the only thing that made any sense was that I guess maybe Apple's going to run their stuff in Google's data centers and on Google's TPUs. That makes sense, because if you're going to do something at the scale of like all iPhone users, it's kind of a big ask for Apple to deploy a bunch of M2 Ultras or whatever their M5 server chip is and deal with all that, whereas Google already has the infrastructure to serve the entire world on whatever it wants to serve. So I bet that deal will go through, but it's interesting that Apple is... I guess they're not announcing anything. This is just a rumor, but Apple traditionally uses, AWS, Azure, all those other things or whatever, but I'm not sure how much Google Cloud stuff they've done. And making this part of the Google deal to use their models definitely makes sense. Maybe they had a good deal on Google servers as well.
I mean, and this makes so much sense in like the big picture way if you consider it to mean that Apple will probably be hosting all of the largest models for Apple Intelligence in Google's data centers. On Google's tech and
designed to run, because Google made the models to run on their hardware.
Well, not only that. I mean, and obviously they're going to be at least starting out running Gemini as the foundation model, and probably, honestly, if I had to guess, would probably stay there for the long term. At this point, I don't see Apple developing their own competitive foundation models that are going to be worth using. I think if they ever do, that's many, many years away. Like, think on the order of like 10 or 20 years away. If it ever happens, and it might just be that they just always use Gemini for the large model stuff. And if you're going to run the very large, flagship level AI models, you're not going to run it on Apple's chips. Because Apple's chips aren't designed for that. And the very, very largest models, the hardware to run those is so specialized that Apple not only isn't going to make something competitive for it, but shouldn't make something competitive for it, because that's fairly far out of their main areas of expertise for their chip designs. You're looking at like the highest end servers from, NVIDIA type stuff, and also Google's custom stuff. Like, that's what this world mostly looks like. And so Google has the whole stack, top to bottom, to serve, to develop these models, to host these models, like, to scale them. Apple is not going to be competitive on that level for a long time, if ever. Where Apple, I think, might be competitive long term is on device models. that makes a lot of sense. That is well within Apple's expertise. You know, maybe not so much in the you know, cutting edge of AI these days, but I feel like they can get there, you know, kind of reasonably in, you know, maybe 5 years. They can probably have their own on-device models being class-leading enough to actually use only their stuff. But for the big, like, world knowledge server models, I don't think – not only are they not in that game now, either in the models or the hardware to serve them, but I don't think they will ever be in that game. And you could probably argue, like, they probably maybe shouldn't try a lot of those things. So I think this is probably bigger than it seems. And I think it's going – and I think this part of it where the just Siri just runs on Google servers, I think that's going to just be the default of how this goes for the foreseeable future. And also, I think that's probably the right move.
This is the chatbot thing only, according to Gurman's rumor here. And I do think they're still going to want to use private cloud compute, which depends on using Apple's software and Apple's hardware and all that other stuff. I think they'll still do that with stuff that deals with your personal information. And maybe just like general chatbot-y stuff will go to this. Kind of like they do the regular chatbot-y stuff to go to ChatGPT now. But we'll see. Still just rumors. And it remains to be seen how much Apple will even talk about this. I mean, the quote-unquote joint statement that we read from was just published by Google, and Apple's not saying anything about it. Do you think Apple's going to even mention whether they're using servers in Google's data centers? It probably just goes completely unsaid.
Oh, yeah. I can't imagine they would mention it. But also, you know, another kind of broader point here is I wouldn't necessarily assume that private cloud compute, the way it was advertised, will be the situation forever or ever. Because everything we saw at that initial Apple Intelligence presentation, like how much of that has actually panned out and will ever pan out?
But it's not 100%. Now, though. But you can use private cloud compute now, and I'm assuming it works exactly like they announced. So that's one of the things they actually did ship.
You can, but it's in a very limited capacity. And like only Apple's apps and for some reason, shortcuts on the Mac can use it. And it's in a very limited capacity at a very limited scale. And if you look at everything else that was announced during that Apple Intelligence presentation, I think a lot of that stuff is going to get memory hold. And we're just going to move on like air power and pretend like it never happened. And the reality of what's delivered might be different because a lot of that stuff didn't pan out. And so I think the assumption that Apple will always run the models that use your personal info on what they already described as private cloud compute, maybe. But I would not assume that's a given. I think it can just as easily end up that they work out the technical details with Google to do something that is similarly private on Google's hardware in Google's data centers with Google's models. I think that is a very, very likely outcome for this, either short term or long term. Because again, this is just this scale of hosting this kind of compute power and developing that kind of model is just not in Apple's wheelhouse. And that's not to say it never can be, but so far Apple has not at all made the required effort to get themselves in that position. So the Apple that we know today, it's like, you know, Apple could at some point get better at lots of things that it's not currently good at, but the Apple that we know today is not good enough in those areas to probably host this the way that we assume that it would be hosted with private cloud compute. I think private cloud compute is going to be probably memory hold in the next few years. And if and when that happens, I don't think that's that big of a problem or scandal or downside, because I'm sure Apple would insist on similar privacy expectations if they did move it to Google. I'm sure they would design the whole thing with Google. They would work with them to ensure all the same privacy and encryption and transparency. Like, I'm sure if they make this change, we would look at it and be like, yeah, that makes sense. And it doesn't matter.
All right, moving right along. I made an offhanded comment/rant about how I copied something out of Apple News and a bunch of other stuff was appended on the side of it and I didn't care for it. And I assumed that was...
Didn't care for it is the understatement of the hour.
Yes, fair enough. And I assumed it was Apple News, if I'm not mistaken, or perhaps the Wall Street Journal or whatever I was copying from. Richard writes, I just sampled 10 different random news articles on Apple News, and they all had the additional text added to the paste. This is definitely an Apple News app thing and not just a Wall Street Journal thing. However, I see this happening more frequently in other apps. I'm in a doctoral program and often take notes by copying and pasting from PDFs. Some just flat out don't let you do that, or they add additional text. Does this have anything to do with how crawlers are being used to train AI? I don't think it has anything to do with that.
They've been doing this since way before there was AI crawlers. It's just a thing. I kind of see the reason. You know, in some instances, you're like, look, this is useful. You probably want the citation anyway, so we're saving you some work. But that assumption doesn't hold in lots of other contexts. And even when it does hold, like for research papers, it just annoys people.
Yep. And then Chris S. writes, clipboard hijacking is an Apple thing. Try copy and pasting something from the transcript in the podcast app. Same thing happens. Cool. Vitor writes, regarding your Apple News complaint of it adding extra text to your copy, you were hesitant to blame Apple News itself, but I wouldn't be. Apple Books has done the exact same thing forever, since the time it was still called iBooks. It is so annoying, I've made an Alfred workflow to simply grab the text within the quotes, ignore everything else, and put it back in my clipboard. Well done. I dig that.
Only on the Mac, as they would say, because iOS and iPadOS don't let you do cool things.
Indeed, John, indeed. All right. Last week, I think it was, we were talking about Grok. Oh, yes, it was last week. Being blocked in Indonesia and Malaysia. And somebody, one of us, maybe it was me, I don't know.
It was me.
Okay, there you go. It's always John, right? John said offhandedly that, what, Indonesia is not big or something along those lines?
Yeah, I said Malaysia, yeah, Indonesia, they were blocking it, and small companies can easily block it. Small countries can easily block it, but I need to be corrected there.
Right. So many people have written that Indonesia's population is about 285 million. And for comparison, the U.S. is about 340 million.
I should have known that because I recently looked at one of those projections of what the world population will be like in 30 or 40 years. And Indonesia was either number one or two. So, yeah, large population and growing real fast.
Whoopsie doopsies. Main stage is not new. We were not familiar with main stage when we were talking about the creative, what is it called? The creative something.
Creator Studio, right?
Creator Studio. Thank you. Pixel Mator. Anyways, main stage is part of the Creator Studio and it is not new. Mike Taffet, amongst many others, wrote in to say that it's been in use, particularly for stage related things, for a long time. And there's a story that Mike pointed us to from mixonline.com. This is in 2008. They talk about how Trent Reznor and Nine Inch Nails uses Mainstage during concerts, and it's being powered by what, John?
Two Xservs. Oh, yeah. The perfect rack-mountable, stage-based Apple computer for your Nine Inch Nails show. Exactly what the people who made that machine intended it for.
That's amazing.
Exactly. Exactly. All right. Apple standalone creative bundle. Pekka Salonen wrote that for education customers, the Pro Apps bundle appears to still be alive. For $200, you get all five Pro Apps, Final Cut Pro, Logic Pro, Motion, Compressor, and Mainstage. It's something to grab perhaps before John's kids graduate, and there is a link in the show notes.
I wonder if they'll keep that around, because they still sell those standalone, and this is just the education bundle standalone, so maybe it's not even going away, but yeah, there you have it.
And speaking of pro apps, and in this case, free trials, Caroline writes, Final Cut and Logic Pro both had a three-month trial versions with all features unlocked. And Caroline heard it was even easy to get reset those trials. Sadly, Apple has removed those now, and Creator Studio's trial period is only 1 month. And then, John, you had asked, I guess, how the three-month free trial worked. Can you tell me about this?
Yeah, because I was like, what do you mean a three-month free trial of Final Cut Pro? The Mac App Store doesn't give free trials for paid upfront apps, so how did they do it?
And then Ian Robinson piped in to say the apps were full versions downloaded from the Apple website. There you go.
There you go.
All right, with regard to monitors at CES, tell me about connectivity, John.
Yeah, we talked a lot about some monitors that were interesting as potentially useful to Mac users, even though they're technically gaming monitors. And there are some caveats that I meant to discuss last week when we discussed these. One is connectivity. I read off all the ports, this has this port and that port with this data rate and so on and so forth. And we got some questions about this, and those questions were warranted, which is okay, but can I hook up my Mac laptop to it? It's great that it has a display port, whatever version on it. It's great that it has HDMI 2.1, but I don't have display port or HDMI ports on my laptop or my Mac. I have Thunderbolt and USB-C and stuff. So can I drive them? Most of the monitors most of these gaming monitors, like the 5K ones, the 4K, the 6K ones that you'll see with Mac relevant DPIs, do support DisplayPort alternate mode for their USB-C port connections. If you look at the specs, but I wouldn't just assume that means, that I can just plug in my Mac laptop with the USB-C cable and everything will work fine, especially for the monitors that are 5 or 6K. So, this is just CES. These products are announced. Some of them have prices, but they're not available for purchase yet. I would suggest that if you have any interest in these monitors, wait to see a review where somebody plugs a Mac into it to see that, yes, it will behave correctly. The macOS doesn't flip out about it, that it can drive it at its full resolution through the thing. Because the last thing you want to do is get one of these monitors, save a bunch of money, it's great performance, then you have to get like a, you know, Thunderbolt to DisplayPort or HDMI dongle hanging off your laptop. You wouldn't like that. So wait for those reviews before you decide to buy one.
Anonymous writes, in the latest episode, you went through the specs and prices of various non-Apple displays, with the general conclusion being that you can get Studio Display physical and pixel dimensions with less money and more refresh rate and HDR. But what kind of color accuracy and HDR mess would one get into if trying to use these with a Mac? Game consoles ask the user to look at a test picture to infer the HDR capability of the TV, which suggests that HDR capability info might not travel properly over EDID, or extended display in identification data. With an Apple display, macOS knows the HDR headroom given the particular brightness setting and can let Lightroom Classic know, so that Lightroom Classic can assume a hard clip in the display pipeline, not do tone mapping. How does HDR work with macOS and a non-Apple display? Where does tone mapping occur with those displays? Are they like TVs in their default mode, tone mapping in the display, or like TVs in HDIG mode, no display side tone mapping? No display side tone mapping. There we go. I can get there. What does it take to get color accurate results for the display P3 color space with Apple and Adobe apps?
These are all excellent questions, and another reason you should absolutely wait to see a review of these monitors, because macOS works very well with Apple monitors. It works okay with non-Apple monitors designed for Mac users, but these displays are, for the most part, not designed to be used with Macs or by Mac users at all, and so they have different priorities. And most of them have enough features where the good thing they have going for them is, as gaming monitors, they're very configurable and they have lots of settings that you can tweak. But if you care very much about like accurate color, you're probably better off shopping one of like those Asus monitors that's made for creative professionals. They're more expensive. They don't have the high refresh rate. They probably don't have the dynamic backlight stuff on them. But their whole point is, we will be color accurate. We either have drivers for them for macOS, so macOS knows about their color profiles and all their capabilities, or else we've tested them to work with Macs. Like I said, MSI, which was the vendor we were talking about a lot last episode, does have a Mac-focused monitor that advertises the fact that their color will exactly match the color on like the internal laptop displays when you're doing color work. So those do exist. But we didn't actually talk about that particular monitor because it was it didn't have as many features. So anyway, all this to say is, these are gaming monitors. They're not monitors for people who care about color accuracy. So wait for the reviews to see if they can be repurposed for that purpose. But the panels that they use will surely be used in monitors aimed at creative professionals. And I can guarantee those will cost less than the Studio Display too.
With regard to ProMotion, Justin Searles writes, recently Marco was talking about how much he appreciated 120Hz ProMotion displays, including in Safari. It's probably the case that Safari renders page scrolling at 120Hz, but I recently learned that rendering page contents is generally capped at 60Hz, unless you dig into feature flags and disable it. This is true on iPhone, iPad Pro, and MacBook Pro. There's a link to a blog post that Justin has written, a very short one. And Justin continues, if you want Safari to render page content at 120Hz, you need to, at least on iOS, you need to go into Settings, Apps, Safari, Advanced, and then Feature Flags. And then there's a setting in there, Prefer Page Rendering Updates Near 60 Frames Per Second, which you need to turn off. You can test the difference at the very amusingly named testufo.com, which will also
by Blurbuster. If anyone has ever watched a review of a gaming monitor, you know about Blurbusters and the little alien.
And for the record, yes, I was just talking about scrolling, because that's where I notice it. I think that is, in terms of like where I notice any high refresh screen above 60 hertz, it's basically in two areas. It's scrolling, and it's when full screen animations come in. So, like on the iPhone, you can I immediately notice iPhone or iPad ProMotion or not by like when you launch an app and the app zooms into place, or you go to the home screen and zooms back out. Any kind of big full screen animation, you notice it. That's what scrolling is. It's a big full screen animation, really. Yeah. So I think, and especially when it tracks your touch, I feel like I notice it more. And so in the case of like, you know, using the scroll wheel to scroll a web page, or you know, using your finger to scroll stuff on a phone or an iPad, that I think is where high DP or high refresh rates are the most noticeable to the most people, certainly including myself.
Well, I think this is like aimed at like somebody who's trying to, you know, something in a web page, like an entire like a WebGL view or like a game you're playing in a web browser or right. something, where even though you're not scrolling, essentially the whole screen is changing constantly and you're wondering why you're not getting more than 60 frames per second on your 120 hertz monitor, the setting is why. You can just try it on the UFO. It's really easy to test. Just go to your phone and go to the UFO thing and you'll see that like it overlays. I think it says something like mixed frame rates or something if you have the cap on, and when you turn the cap off, you can see, oh, the top one is 120 and the bottom one is 60, and I can tell the difference.
Yeah. And I apologize to you, John. I forgot that there was a little bit of Vision Pro corner here in follow-up, so my bad. But when way back when we were talking about how Tiff could make her holiday slideshows, and one of us made a offhanded remark about how you can't edit Keynote files on the Vision Pro. I forget why we said this, but we did. And Anonymous writes, you can edit Keynote files on the Apple Vision Pro. Internally, it was a bit of a hero case, to use some terminology Marco won't understand, in what can be done in the productivity space, and definitely has the most complicated UI of any of the first party apps.
Yeah, I was suggesting using Keynote to make the slideshow, and I think you two were talking about how you can't do it in the Vision Pro because Keynote's not available, but apparently it is.
Turns out. All right, let's do some topics, and it sounds like, John, you might have a little bit of complaining to do with regard to Tahoe.
I mean, some people have a little bit of complaining to do. We'll see how much mm-hmm. I have to do. This is a story from a couple weeks ago. It kind of got pushed out by other news that was a little bit more timely, like the CES stuff. You may have seen this going around the internet in early January, but people have been complaining about it for a while since Tahoe. The article that became very popular is Nikita Prokopov. Did I say that right? Prokopov, who I know as Nikki Tonsky on Mastodon. He has a post called "It's Hard to Justify Tahoe Icons" that goes through in very extensive detail the history of icons next to menu items on the Mac, the current recommendations for them, and the current implementation of that in Tahoe. There have been other articles on the same topic, including one that was eventually referenced by the Tonsky's article, which is by Jim Nielsen from December 7th. But essentially ever since Tahoe was shown, there was a lot of discussion around the Mac user interface nerd community about icons in menu bars or in menu items. Like we're talking about the pull down menus at the top of the screen. You go to the menu bar, you pull down like the file or edit menu or any of those menus. And the recommendation in Tahoe is to put icons next to a bunch of menu items that previously did not have any icons. And a lot of people are upset about it. And I'm pretty sure Marco read this article because he commented on it.
Oh, yes.
So why don't you two begin? What are your thoughts on this topic? Because this was a very popular article for a couple weeks.
I think the article does a really good job of explaining why having icons next to every single menu item as a best practice or as a requirement, why that falls apart. It's one of those things that I think in interface design, I'm sure lots of designers over time have thought, oh, that sounds like a good idea. Let's try it. And then normally the feedback process would be you try it and you realize, oh, there's a lot of cases in which this doesn't work, or this is making things worse, or it's causing, you know, confusion, or you have to really pick some symbols that don't really work because certain menu commands just don't really work well as little icons next to them, or like there's no obvious icon choice. And then maybe you might have, you know, different programmers at different times on different teams choosing different icons for the same or similar actions over time. Or maybe you might have a whole bunch of menu items in a row that all kind of should maybe be the same icon or a similar one. And then you're like, what do you do that? And in a normal process, you know, that those would be tried, or these failures would be done internally, and then the review would happen and they would be like, this actually is not working. We're going to change this idea, or we're going to cancel this idea. That last part didn't happen at Apple, and all of those mistakes, they just made them all and shipped it as Tahoe.
I mean, you're not wrong. For me, I'm not as bothered by this as it seems everybody else is, which isn't to say I disagree with any particular thing you've said or any particular thing on these sites. In fact, Nikita's post in particular does a very thorough job, as you guys were saying, of chronicling exactly why this is wrong, right, they put up, you know, screenshots of the original Higg. I don't even know if it was called the Higg at that point, but I presume it was, talking about how you should absolutely not do the following. And then a picture of Tahoe doing exactly that, which is really special. It's not great, but I don't find it as actively bothersome as I think basically everyone else does. So I don't have too much to say on this other than that I think it needs to be better. It needs to be better than it is. It seems that there's a clear lack of consistency. It's clear that the left hand and the right hand are not talking, which is a very Apple thing. Reading the article, I got very mad. And then after I moved on to something else, I had to stop being mad. So it's kind of whatever, man. I'm sure, John, you feel very strongly that this is absolutely accurate and terrible in every way, and I would love to hear you rant about it. But for me, it sucks, but whatever.
Well, and to be clear, before we let John explode, I'm with you, Casey, with in terms of how much it makes me angry. Like, Tahoe has a lot of little paper cuts for me. I don't like a lot about Tahoe. Icons and menus are one of those paper cuts, but it's not super high on the list. I think it's kind of a microcosm of the design failings in general of the Allen Dye era of software. It's like, what happens when this group of, you know, people, principles, trends, whatever it is, whatever came together to form Tahoe? It's like, what happened here? And, you know, there's a lot of failings to investigate, but like, to me, like the menu icons, again, like, it's not. And I don't think these articles claimed that was like the worst thing about Tahoe. Just it shows a
lack of care.
Yeah, a lack of care and a lack of talent, honestly, like a lack of design talent and a lack of respecting the platform that it's on and that it's redesigning. Like, you know, I kind of, you know, brashly said a few months back that Allen Dye doged his way through macOS with Tahoe. That is how it feels. Like, you know, like, what did Doge do for the government? They tore through a bunch of departments without really understanding them. They hastily and sloppily tore stuff apart and put in their own ideas without really, you know, the whole Chesterton Fence thing, like, without really understanding why anything was there, certainly without respecting it, and while thinking they knew everything. That's Allen Dye's team with Tahoe. They tore through the Mac, and they messed a bunch of stuff up, a lot of times needlessly, to create something that, you know, by goals and by people that don't really seem to get the platform, certainly don't seem to respect the platform, and seem to not have taken a lot of care doing it.
Casey mentioned the original Mac human interface guidelines. The ones cited in the Tonski article are from 1992. The originals are back in the 80s when the Mac was first introduced. I think they were called the Apple human interface guidelines. I'm not sure if they ever went from user to human, but anyway, rest assured that human interface guidelines, or HIG, is a term from the classic macOS era. And the thing people always cite is the graphic that's at the top of this thing is basically from the 1992 HIG saying, don't put symbols next to menu items, because and they give reasoning for it. You know, they say, here's why, you know, they say, don't do this, do this instead, and here's why. The HIG always used to give good reasons for things that ended, not in the Allen Dye era, that ended way before that, but they were usually pretty good about giving justifications for things based on, you know, either research they had done themselves or research done by other people, or matters of taste that were, you know, people could agree with. Now, when Tahoe, I think not even before it came out, when Tahoe was first revealed, I guess it was like a WWDC or whatever, and the menu, the icons were in the menu, next to the menu items, I commented on it then, and I don't think my opinion on it has changed much since then. The Hard Justify Tahoe Icons article does a good job of really showing how poor the implementation is. Because setting aside, which I'll get to in a little bit, the wisdom of putting an icon next to menu items, the way that has been executed in Tahoe is just riddled with really basic rookie mistakes. Like, it's inconsistent. It's, you know, they don't follow their own advice that they gave. It needlessly obfuscate things that would otherwise be clearer if there were no icons. That just the icons themselves are scaled to a size where they're so small that it's difficult to tell what they are, even on a Retina display. They just did a bad job of executing it. But setting aside the execution, if you were to have, in your particular application, the perfect execution, you don't make all the mistakes that Apple made, is this a good idea? And I think what I said at the time about it when we first saw Tahoe was like, there is actually some justification for having an icon be aid in the recognition of a menu item. So a tiny symbol that you could recognize without having to read the words of the menu item can help you find a menu item more quickly than if you had to scan the words, right? Especially in really big menus with like applications that have huge menus like Photoshop or whatever, they go on for a long time. The whole point of icons is rather than asking you to read text, maybe you can recognize a symbol. Now, obviously, that only works if a couple of things are true. First, you kind of have to use the same symbol for the same commands. So everyone needs to decide, this is the symbol we're going to use for copy. This is the symbol we're going to use for new. This is the symbol we're going to use for export. Because if you don't, it really doesn't help. Because you're like, let me find the export command. You're scanning the little menu icons for what you think is the export icon, which is like a box with an arrow coming up out of it. But this one uses a box with an arrow going down to it, or a different box with an arrow going sideways. Or like, you've blown that if it's not consistent across the OS. It's almost as if like when you go to like, you know, file open, you're looking for the word open. But if different apps chose a different word than open, it would really mess you up. It'd be like open, retrieve, you know, like
load.
Expand, load. Like, but just how about everyone just agrees on open? The same exact thing applies to icons. You really have to have a standard set of icons. Second thing is, the icons next to menu items, especially in 1992, were infeasible because the display resolution was 72 dpi. You just can't draw anything next to a menu item that's recognizable, or you can draw a very limited number of things that's next to a menu item that is recognizable at that DPI. With the advent of Retina, making symbols that are, you have more, the problem space is bigger. You can make more different symbols that are all recognizable because we have finer resolution on our displays. So just because they said in 1992, don't put symbols next to menus, take a look at like that screenshot of the 72 dpi. What can you even do with that many pixels? There's not much you can do, but now you can. So I think a lot of the reason that was against putting icons next to menu items in the 90s no longer holds. But, you know, Apple being Apple in the Allen Dye era, they chose to make the icons next to menu items smaller than they really needed to be, because it looks nicer for them to be this size. And I agree, it does look nicer. Like, if you look in the screenshot of, like, Open Recent, it's got, I think it's supposed to be a clock icon. God help us. A clock icon next to Open Recent, all right? Whatever. Like, that open icon with the slanted arrow, whatever. Anyway, and you can see how the clock is kind of the same size as the capital O in Open, and it does look nice. But there's actually more, you could make that icon bigger. Like, there's more room in the menu for the icon to be bigger. So they could have made it more recognizable and made the icons less look like blurry smudges, which is kind of what a lot of them look like from reasonable like Mac using distances, but they didn't because this looks nicer. So another black mark on them. Now, if you look in Apple's actual guidelines, which we will link in the show notes, what they actually say, and again, I read this when the WWDC, which is why I wasn't so super mad about it then, is they say, you know, icons help people recognize common actions. Which is just what I'm saying. Icons help you recognize things. Use the same icons as the system to represent actions such as copy, share, and delete wherever they appear. For a list of icons that represent common actions, see standard icons, and they give a link to a list of standard icons you're supposed to use for common commands. Unfortunately, that list is very short. It's like, there's not enough common icons, and even Apple doesn't follow its own advice. And then they go on, don't display an icon if you can't find one that clearly represents the menu item. Not all menu items need an icon. I don't know why everyone complaining about this hasn't seen this guideline, but they're like, oh, Apple wants you to put an icon next to every menu item. They absolutely don't. They say they don't, okay? And they also have some other advice. They give an example like when you shouldn't have any icons next to things like the days of the week. None of those deserve icons, although Casey would put them there because it looks fun. He would use emoji, though.
wow.
And then they do another thing where it's like, what is it? Use a single icon to introduce a group of similar items. Instead of adding individual icons for each action or reusing the same icon for all of them, establish a common theme with the symbol for the first item and rely on the menu item text to keep the remaining items distinct. So they give an example of a bunch of copy things, copy symbol, copy name, copy image as, copy code. They're all next to each other in the menu. Only the first copy command has the copy icon and the rest of them have no icon. So the problem with this advice And I think that the problem that everyone is finding is, like, first of all, people are not grokking or internalizing this advice, because the advice requires the developer to make too many judgment calls. If they had just said every single menu item needs an icon, at least people would understand that. But they didn't say that. They said not all menu items need an icon. So then you're like, okay, which of my menu items need an icon and why? Because the directions say they help people recognize common options, so should it just be on common ones? Or, like, should it just be from that standard icon list? Like, and then you end up with things like in this article where it's just a hodgepodge of menu items. Some of them have icons, some of them don't. Why do some of them have icons? Why do some of them not have icons? Is it because the one with icons are more commonly used? And it changes the indenting because of the way they implemented it? It's just a poorly explained, like, what do they want? What do they want? They want people to recognize icons, but they make them too small. They don't want them on every menu item, and they don't want them to be repeated. But if they're not repeated, then how can you find an item by its icon? You just have to look at the one above it that's similar to that and scroll down. And how is a developer supposed to decide which menu items should have icons? So I don't think the idea of having icons in menus is an inherently bad idea. I think it can actually help. I mean, we have it right now. Like, the example everybody uses in all these articles, which is 100% true, is when you go into the little green, like, window widget menu on a Mac window title bar, and you get that little pop-up menu, and you see those little symbols, you'll also see them in the window menu on some applications as well, like in the move and resize submenu under the window menu. Those icons do a better job of the words left, right, top, bottom, top, left, top, right, bottom. Like, I bet people never even read those words. I bet they just look at the symbols.
Yeah,
because
yeah.
There's enough pixels in those symbols that the symbols add clarity and make it faster for people to find things. I mean, those didn't come in Tahoe. They've been there since I'm looking at them right now in Sequoia, right? They didn't come in Tahoe, right? But that proves the idea that icons next to menu items can be helpful for the reasons they describe. But someone somewhere decided they wanted to see a lot more menus because they think it looks cool, and they gave really no guidance to developers for how and when to deploy them. Their list of standard icons is too short, and the result is this article. That you go through macOS, look at Apple's own applications and how they choose to use icons, and it does not help. Does it make things worse? It arguably makes things uglier. Sometimes it hurts the ability to scan down the menu because of the indenting changes in a few cases. But in general, I think this is just it's an example of not the worst change in the world, but every aspect of the execution is bad. And so in the end, it is essentially a net negative to Tahoe, and Tahoe is worse. Tahoe's menus are worse than the pre-Tahoe menus because they look noisier and uglier, and you learn to tune out the symbols for the reasons outlined in this article because you cannot rely on them. They are not consistent across Apple's apps, let alone third-party apps, and the result of this is a bunch of the indie developers we know all coming up with schemes to remove the icons from their own applications so at least their icons can have clean menus, but that further increases the inconsistency because now some apps don't have icons at all. So I'm not, apparently to Casey's surprise, strongly against icons ever being in menu because the 1992 Higgs said they shouldn't be. Absolutely not. Things change, right? But I am for well thought out, well articulated guidelines in the human interface guidelines that developers understand how to follow, that Apple follows itself, and that following them makes the OS better. And this fails on all those fronts. and one final item, which Colin M. Ford had a great tweet about this. This is actually, I believe, from an iPad menu. Which I know isn't a Tahoe thing, but, same deal, icons and menus. It is the writing direction submenu of, I think, an edit menu.
This is incredible.
The format menu. And writing direction is like if it's a left to right or right to left language. And the writing direction is a menu with a submenu, and the submenu items are default, right to left, and left to right. The writing direction submenu itself uses an icon next to writing direction that has a left-facing arrow stacked on top of a right-facing arrow. The submenu choices, default, right to left, and left to right, all use exactly the same icon, a left-facing arrow over a right-facing arrow, except the default menu item has a smaller, slightly, left-facing arrow over a right-facing arrow. Like, it's right there, people. Right to left and left to right. The right to left arrow is an arrow that points from right to left. and the left to right arrow is an arrow of the points. But they didn't even do that. They use both arrows on every single menu item. This is a perfect example of icons not helping with recognition, not helping with clarity, with an extra bit of completely meaningless inconsistency with the default icon being smaller than the right to left or left to right ones. Just chef's kiss, as they say.
Also, to point out, like this, so all of these icons, as far as I can tell, I think all the ones I saw, they're all part of Apple's SF Symbols library. This is a library of standard platform icons that Apple provides developers, and they use all over their own apps as well. I use them heavily in Overcast, like the whole playlist picker. Those are all SF Symbols, and it's a great icon library. But I think, you know, one of the problems that I occasionally have with SF Symbols, of course, everyone using it would have this problem, is sometimes you can't quite find exactly what you want, so you kind of settle for one that's already there, because like making your own entire symbol from scratch, that takes more work. And if you can find one that's kind of close, sometimes you're like, you know what, that'll work, I'll just use that. Well, it seems like the task of putting icons on every single menu item in macOS, it seemed like they didn't add any SF symbols as part of this process. They were probably working in a hurry because they had a lot of work to go through every single Apple menu item.
You don't have to put an icon next to every single menu, but we won't tell you which ones you do have to put it next.
Well, right. But anyway, it looks like part of the, you know, mediocre execution here is that they seem to, of course, like much of this redesign, seem to be doing it in a bit of a rush. And they just picked whatever icon they could find in SF Symbols that was close enough. And that's how you get things.
Like, so one team picked one icon for the same command as another team picked another icon.
Right, exactly. So you have, again, just kind of like a mediocre execution. And the idea, again, like the whole idea of SF Symbols is unification. We're going to unify the way and standardize the way everything looks and works. And in some cases, in some contexts, that's a good idea. But when you start applying these like blanket philosophies without looking at the results, without looking at how the real world and real needs might conflict with that or might have non-ideal outcomes, you get mediocrity. And that's just everything about Tahoe's liquid glass redesign is like there are certain contexts in which some of these things might work well, but in practice, the way it was applied and maybe the way it will always need to be applied with macOS, with the realities of the way some of these things are, it just doesn't have good, actual, practical outcomes. And that's the kind of thing that a good design team and a good design process and a good feedback process would try a bunch of stuff before it ships, of course. But there wasn't a filter to get it out before it got here. And I think this goes to, like, you know, Gruber's talked a lot about this, how, you know, Alan Dye leaving Apple was not Apple's choice. You know, we are all celebrating it. but Alan Dye left for Meta, by all accounts, on his own accord, and Apple was caught by surprise, and presumably as a result, maybe didn't want him to leave, or certainly was not asking him to leave, which means that all the other Apple senior leadership fully supported this. Craig Federighi fully supported this. Tim Cook fully supported this. Like, that's
I'm not
on
sure if Craig
them.
Federighi supported it. I think that Alan Dye's peers in the org chart, their opinion is unknown. Tim Cook, yes, apparently thought it was fine because he's the person. Anyone above Alan
Jeff
Dye
Williams clearly must have supported
fine.
It too.
Yeah, you know? Sure. So anyone above him in the org chart, but I have an easy time believing some of Alan Dye's peers in the org charts were not happy about this, including potentially Craig Federighi, who had to junk up all the OSs he's in charge of with designs that he didn't agree with from Alan Dye. I don't know if that's true, but it's plausible that it could be.
I suspect that, you know, because you think like which of the top execs probably had to be supportive of Alan Dye and this direction for this to ship. And I'm thinking at minimum, Tim Cook, Jeff Williams, Craig Federighi, and Jaws. I think they all, because that's marketing software, like I think they all would have had to at least be supportive of this. So as we think about where this is going to go in the future, yeah, we have a new design leader, Stephen, what's his last name?
LeMay?
Yeah, Stephen LeMay. Yeah. So that's great. We have a new design leader. By everything we've heard, it sounds like Stephen LeMay is like a great person for the principles that we care about. But all those high executives who allowed this and maybe even supported and maybe even liked this, they're all still there except Jeff Williams. So I don't know how much is actually going to change, because the system in place that got Allen die this power and supported this and let all of this mediocrity ship is still the system there for the most part. So I'm a little worried that we're not going to actually see as much change as we want, because all those other people, with the exception of Jeff Williams, are still there.
Well, my opinion of those people you listed is that Tim Cook always recuses himself from these conversations because he has no opinion whatsoever, which certainly doesn't help. That Jeff Williams, if he was above Alan Dye in the org chart, probably supported it, and he has bad taste, but he's gone now. That Jaws may or may not have supported it, but I think Jaws will actually be reactive to public opinion. And at the very least, Jaws is aware that the people who care the most about user interface hate Tahoe with a passion. So I think Jaws will change his opinion if he did support it. And I think Craig was not super into it, but had to do it because it's part of his job. That's just a guess. I have no inside information. If anyone does have inside information about who at Apple loved what Alan Dye was doing and who hated it, please feel free to write us, because I would love to know. But I mean, the end result is, you know, this is what the company did. And so that's that. I have heard from that the new, you know, Steve LeMay being in charge, that he is not particularly forceful in fighting for what he believes in, according to one vaguely sourced story that I saw at some point. But, you know, fingers crossed. Like, certainly it's better than Alan Dye still being there, which is a powerful person whose opinions that we disagree with and who makes bad decisions about UI. We'll see if we can make better decisions in the future.
All right, speaking of Tahoe and weird UI bits, Tahoe window resizing. Norbert Heger writes, since upgrading to macOS Tahoe, I've noticed that quite often my attempts to resize a window are failing. It turns out that my initial click in the window corner instinctively happens in an area where the window doesn't respond to it. The window expects this click to happen in an area of 19 by 19 pixels located near the window corner. If the window had no rounded corners at all, 62% of that area would lie inside the window. But due to the huge corner radius in Tahoe, most of it, about 75%, now lies outside the window. So I was just messing with this with Safari on 26.2, and either this has been fixed, or I am just a unicorn that can hit it every time. Because looking at Norbert's post, I don't doubt anything he said was accurate. And this was only written a couple of weeks ago. But I don't know. Maybe I'm a CEC unicorn, so maybe I'm a window sizing unicorn.
If you just do it real slow motion, a pixel at a time, I reproduced exactly what was seen in this video. Because the first thing I tried to do was reproduce it to see if this is just like a weird situation or if it's true. And I could reproduce exactly as shown. It just takes some very careful movement of the cursor. What this is getting to is like, if you put like the tip of your arrow cursor in the corner of a window, like the window is white and your background is blue, like in this little animation, and you put the tip of your arrow cursor inside the white part on the corner, you expect to be able to resize it, but you can't because you're now outside the region that allows you to click and resize. Because the region itself is sort of focused around the corner of a square window. But the windows aren't square anymore, so it ends up in this perverse scenario where if you visually try to resize the window, you'll essentially grab nothing. He's got a cool animation of him trying to grab a rounded plate by grabbing the air next to it and not being able to move
good.
It. That's exactly what it is. Like, look at the article. He's got little regions. I think he mapped it out essentially a pixel at a time using the cursor. Like, you don't need to be quick to do this. You can do it as slow as you want, move your cursor one pixel at a time, you know, zoom in with the accessibility zoom if you need to have more precise control. It's just bad. Like the resized region does not match the curved shape. It's very bad. 75% of the region being outside the window, that's bad. Some of it has to be outside the window because you want to be able to grab like near the outside of the window, but too much is outside. And some people were like, I bet the people, you know, who work on macOS who hate Alan Dye intentionally did this implementation to make his design look bad. I don't think that's the case. No. I think that this is a pretty easy explanation of why this is like this. Well, first of all, it does highlight that if you want to do this design with the big rounded corners, which I think is a terrible idea, but if you insist on doing it, you now face a challenge. And the challenge is, okay, if I just move the region that you can click to resize a window so it makes sense with the rounded corners, you may break third-party applications. You may break first-party applications because the window resize area is a place where the OS grabs your clicks for standard window management actions, not the OS, but the framework like AppKit or whatever. That region is reserved for window resizing. But if you move that region up because the window curve, and now you have to like move that region up and farther into the content area, you may be blocking content in someone's app that you used to be able to click, but that you can no longer click because a click in that region now clicks on the content. Making changes like this, I've decided that different regions of the window belong to like the framework for the, you know, window resizing. And you can see it happening on iPad, the same thing. breaks applications. I have applications on my iPad that haven't been updated for the iPad OS 26, where there are parts of the app that are under the regions that are now reserved for like window control stuff if you're in windowing mode on iPadOS. If they did this on macOS, they would have been in exactly the same situation, where there would have been some app where you can't reach some control that's in the lower right corner because the window resize area has moved up to it. So I think they were faced, you know, a problem of their own creation. Hey, let's super curve the corner on our windows to give less room for content. And they had to make a choice. Do we move the window resize region and break applications, or do we leave it where it is and make window resizing more difficult? And they chose the second bad choice, which is to leave the window resizing area where it is and make windows harder to resize. And the benefit they get from that is they won't break as many applications. Yet another reason why Tahoe's design choices are bad.
How do you really feel, John? All right, and then rounding out our triplet of Tahoe complaints, I wish I had something alliterative there. Tahoe wants you to update, or I guess prior versions of the OS want you to update to Tahoe periodically, or ask you to update periodically. And Rob Griffiths, who is the creator of macOS Hints and is now at Many Tricks, the creator of Moom, Witch, and many other apps, writes, "I found a way to block the Tahoe update prompts in 90-day chunks anyway. Now when I go to System Settings, General Software Updates, I see this." And there's a screenshot. "Your Mac is running the latest software update allowed by your organization, which is Sequoia 15.7.3. The secret? Using device management profiles, which let you enforce policies on Macs in your organization, even if that quote-unquote organization is one Mac on your desk. One of the available policies is the ability to block activities related to major macOS updates for up to 90 days at a time, the max that the policy allows, which seems like exactly what I needed. However, Rob updates, are we sure we want to read this, John? Because I don't...
Yeah.
All right.
It's from the article that we're going to link.
All right. I don't know if we should be calling attention to it. But anyway, based on some comments on my Mastodon post, this only works due to a bug in macOS 15.7.3. The 90-day period isn't supposed to be a rolling date, but 90 days from the release date. So it should have no impact, but it does. So I hope Apple doesn't fix the bug.
Yeah, so this...
Great.
I think I've complained about a few times on this show, the day Tahoe 26.0 was released, I got a red badge with a 1 in it on System Settings on my Mac, saying, hey, there's a software update. Other people tell me that didn't happen to them. The 26.0 came out, and System Settings didn't have a badge, and they weren't bothered by it. But as time has passed, more and more people are becoming increasingly bothered to update Tahoe. Maybe you've seen recently a big notification appear in the upper right-hand corner of your Mac screen that's a little bit taller than a normal notification that says, hey, did you know Tahoe's out? And it wants you to update. Maybe System Settings in your dock now has a red 1 and a badge on it because software update knows that Tahoe is available to you. This suggestion from Rob is a little bit involved. It involves running shell scripts to add special profiles and blah, blah, blah. And in my experience, you have to do it on every individual account on a Mac so they all don't see the badge, because in my household, the badge has spread to all of the Macs and all of the accounts. But I hate that badge so much that I did it. It's a Git repository, and then you do some little bit of manual tweaking. It's a little bit tech nerdy. Read Rob's post. It's not too hard to do. It is a little bit tedious, but it gives you a 90-day window when that badge will go away. And I asked, I did it, and then the badge didn't go away. Like, my software update said, you're running the latest software allowed by your organization. I'm like, great, that's great. Why is the badge still there? The badge will eventually go away. Sometimes you need to log out and back in. Sometimes you need to check for update a couple times. Rest assured, the badge will eventually leave. And then Rob also suggests making an alias. Once you've installed the thing once, you can make an alias to sort of re-up it for another 90 days. So the next time a badge appears, you can just open Terminal and type no Tahoe and hit return, and it will re-up it for another 90 days. Still have to do that on every account. But I set up those aliases and I set up those things just so I won't be bothered to upgrade to Tahoe, because I don't plan to do that anytime soon. If ever, if you are in the same camp, this is the blog post for you. Thank you, Rob Griffiths, for figuring this out. I hope Apple never does fix this bug. And if they do fix it, you know, I mean, I've lived with it since 26.0 was out until this week. And now I have a blessed vacation. If 15.7.4 comes out and they fix this, I'll be pretty surprised, because normally at that point they're just doing security updates. But, you know, it is what it is.
So, John, at this point, what is, and I'm genuinely asking you, what is keeping you away from Tahoe? Like, obviously you have complaints, but what is it about Tahoe that's enough to say, it's not ready for me?
There's nothing drawing me to it, and okay, many things repelling me. So it's just it's a pretty easy bounce. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like I just everything I use it every time I do software development for my apps. Like I have to be using it. Like I'm using Xcode in Tahoe. Like it's unavoidable. My apps run Tahoe. They're updated for Tahoe. I'm fixing Tahoe specific bugs. It's not like I'm not using Tahoe. Like I know what it's like. I'm using it every single week for some period of time. Although often I remote desktop into the little the MacBook Air on my big screen so I can get a little bit bigger screen. But I'm using it, but that experience has just led me to think, like, I don't want this on my main Mac. There are no features of it that make a big difference to me, and there are many things about it that I dislike. So I might just skip it entirely and hope 27 fixes something, but we'll see. I just take it on a day-by-day basis. I do that balancing act. Like, for example, if there was some app that only ran on 26 that I desperately wanted, I would update. You know what I mean? Like, yeah, but there needs to be something pulling me to it. And right now there isn't, and there's a lot of things pushing me away.
So no carrots, maybe a couple of sticks, but
yeah, oh, a lot. So many sticks.
All right, so let's do some Ask ATP, because coincidentally our Ask ATP tonight largely relates to what we just talked about. So Austin writes, was Alan Dye a better or worse steward of software design than Johnny Ive? This is a really good question. I don't know if I have a good answer for this. And it's so hard, too, because we make assumptions about whose fault or whose design, you know, was whose based on when Dye was there and when Ive was there. But, I mean, they crossed over for ways, didn't they? So what if Johnny, you know, delegated to Alan Dye?
I think the only way we can answer this question is basically just roll up every bit of, like, the buck stops with the person at the head of UI design. So when it was Ive, we're just gonna you know, obviously not truthfully, but we're just going to assign all blame and all credit to everything having to do with software design to the head of software design during the Ive period and during the Dye period. And as you noted, that's not actually how the world works, but that's how it works with the buck stops here thing. You know, you may not have done the work, but in the end, you were in charge of it, so it all falls on you.
Yeah, and also, Alan Dye was Johnny Ive's selected software chief, or, you know, software design chief. Like, that was kind of like how that worked out from everything we've heard, like, delegation wise. When Johnny Ive was the head of all design at Apple, he, by all accounts, was massively overworked. Now, that was in many ways self-imposed. You know, we've heard stories of him, like, really diving in and getting it, like, really having an opinion about all the little details. You know, they were building Apple Park at the time. That was a massive undertaking for everybody, but also, you know, in particular for Johnny Ive. He involved himself in lots of the design of that. They were doing, you know, he was designing everything at Apple, and even some things outside of Apple.
He already had a foot out the door at that point, too, and he'd already asked to leave, and Tim Cook had convinced him to stay, according to the rumors.
Yeah, but it was very clear that, you know, Johnny Ive was spread very thin at that time. And so while it was, you know, while Johnny Ive was the one in charge of all design at Apple, I think, from what we've heard, Alan Dye was, we're pretty much... I don't think there's that much of a distinction between the Alan Dye era and the Johnny Ive era in terms of software design, because I think Alan Dye was kind of always that person. You know, there are obviously some questions about, like, you know, how many filters these people have to go through on the way up the chain to get things approved and get things out the door. You know, how much power they have, how many checks and balances different needs and departments have. That all changes over time, and we don't have a great insight into that, except for occasional random things we hear. But I don't think we can really draw a distinction between these two, because I think the Alan Dye era that we call it today is just an extension of the Johnny Ive era, both of which were extensions of Tim Cook putting all design on Johnny because Tim Cook doesn't understand design or computers or humanity.
Well, I think following the guideline that I set down, I have no problem drawing distinction here. I'm blaming everything in the Alan Dye in the Ive era on Ive, and everything in the Alan Dye era on Dye. Whether or not, to Marco's point, there was overlap, I'm just saying, look, if you're in charge, the buck stops with you. And by that criteria, it's easy for me. Dye era worse, no contest. Even though I didn't like a lot of the stuff that Johnny Ive did with software, if you look at what is Johnny Ive's signature achievement or project or whatever, I would say was iOS 7. And for all the complaints about iOS 7, comparing it to Alan Dye's sort of crowning achievement, which is the 26 OSs, oh my God, iOS 7 was better than 26 OSs. Like,
yeah.
You know, we all had complaints about iOS 7 and it went a little bit overboard, but the general design direction wasn't terrible. And I think it was like a needed break from the style that came before it, and it evolved into something pretty good. And it was better than 20X OS's from day one. It was better thought out. It was better. There was more reasoning behind it. The mistakes that it made, it pretty quickly fixed. Granted, we don't know if that's going to happen with 20X's because it's just been out for a year. But pretty much everything else I've did with software is not as bad as I think all the things Alan Dye has done in the era when he has been there and Johnny has not. To be clear, I don't like what either one of them did with the software. I don't like. I'm not saying either one was good, but if I had to personally pick, it is Ive was better than Dye.
Yeah, I think if we're comparing, you know, if we take like the people's names off of it, and if we compare the big iOS 7 redesign to the big iOS 26 redesign, I agree. iOS 7 did have a lot of problems. And it, but I think where iOS 7 was better is that it left a lot more room to tweak it into something that ended up being pretty good. Whereas the 26 OSs, I mean, maybe because they're just brand new and it's hard for us to see right now, but like a lot of the changes that 26 made, it's hard to look at them and find a good path out that isn't just like going back to a different style entirely.
Yeah, and the benefits aren't as clear. Like iOS 7, like it was such a clear contrast, and we could see this is doing X, Y, and Z better than the other era. It does some things worse, but I see where it is an improvement. I see how it is a refreshing change. I see the areas where it is better. I see the benefits for app development. I feel like iOS 7 really did make it easier to develop apps that conform to different screen sizes and that are flexible. And it did make app development easier in kind of the same way that SF Symbols did, and sort of making Apple caliber design approachable to developers who weren't artistic experts. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah.
And I know, like, I'm sure someone's listening to this saying, you dummies, Alan Dye designed all of iOS 7. Like, that's not the point here. I'm just saying, when Ive was in charge, what did Apple put out? I'm not saying who did it. I don't care if Alan Dye designed every single thing on that was released under Johnny Ive when he was in charge. I'm assigning names to eras when they were in charge. When Ive was in charge, the software Apple put out was better than the software put out when Dye was in charge, regardless of who is actually responsible for that software.
Yeah.
Like, who actually did the work.
Yeah, but ultimately, neither one of them really showed that much of a respect for UI design.
Like, but Ive was a good hardware designer, mostly.
Yeah, and I think...
You can't say that for Dye.
Right, like, that's the whole, you know, original sin here. What set Apple off in a bad direction with software design was basically a disregard or an ignorance of UI design as a separate discipline from visual design, the graphic design.
Just one of those design people. You just know design things. Just do the software too. Same thing, right?
Right. It's like, yeah, like all doctors are the same, right? Like
you, exactly.
Yeah, like there's definitely, like, you know, certainly
you have a doctor in philosophy, do the surgery.
Yeah, I have a problem with my foot. They're my podiatrist too. Like they're just the head of doctor. This one doctor, since they're good at this one kind of doctoring, can obviously do all kinds of doctoring, right? Because it's all the same.
Yeah, it's the Peter principle. Johnny Ive was promoted to his level of incompetence.
Right. And I think that, like, that's what I want to see change. And that's what gives me hope with Stephen LeMay being elevated, because it does sound, by all accounts, that he is more of the traditional UI design kind of person. And we haven't really had a lot of that in Apple's software design leadership, really, since Forstall left. Like, that was when that era ended. And it isn't to say that they haven't put out any good software design since. In particular, I think as iOS 7 kind of evolved and morphed, I think somewhere around the iOS 12 to 15 era, it got pretty good. Like, that was actually a really good era of iOS software design. The Mac, I think, has had a lot of problems for most of
this
time.
One of the things about iOS 7 is it didn't touch the Mac, which was merciful. Like, the Mac got sort of sideswiped by a bunch of iOS-isms as time went on, but iOS 7, when it landed, did not also land with a thud on the Mac.
Right, exactly. because again, like, with the Mac, as we've talked about many times in the show, Apple doesn't really put the resources into the Mac that they put into iOS. And there's, you know, you can understand why, obviously. Like, that's an understandable reason why they would do that. So what tends to happen on the Mac is whatever they need to do for iOS, the Mac kind of gets a half-assed version that doesn't have as many resources. It's being applied to a kind of a more complex more heavily legacy code base and software library and just a larger surface area in terms of like the needs it has to cover. Like on the Mac, it's a huge surface area, way bigger than software or UI has to cover on iOS. But because it is lower priority in Apple, because it's not as big of a business, it gets fewer resources. So it ends up getting fewer resources at a lower priority to solve what is often more complicated UI problems. So as a result, Mac UI redesigns in the modern Apple era tend to be half-assed, incomplete, and not that great. And those dynamics aren't going to change. The Mac is not going to get a ton of UI design resources from Apple if iOS needs them first. And iOS
that's
will
why
always
it just needs
them
to be divorced from the iOS release schedule. Like the whole idea of doing a 26 OS like and having it go across all the OSs with this big redesign, you're dooming the Mac because, as you said, it's going to get fewer resources. So if you have your resources on the Mac, the ideal thing would be, okay, the Mac gets updated half as much, a quarter as much, right? Just you don't have the resources to do an update at the same interval you do the iOS update, which means you can't do this coordinated, all of our platforms get updated to the new design at the same time. Setting aside the fact that always, even before all the 26 OSs and anything, any kind of update the Mac would get was never designed to make the Mac better. It was just designed to make the Mac fit in with whatever the iOS did like 2 years ago, back when it was delayed. Like, so it needs to be not connected schedule-wise. It can't be in sync with iOS. And also, the changes need to be designed to make the Mac better. And those two things haven't been true in a while. It's a real shame.
And I think the whole idea that we need to unify everything about these platforms, not only I think is a bad idea for a lot of reasons, and I think it's misapplied in tons of ways, because they're different platforms. They work very differently. They're used very differently in different contexts by different people. So I think the idea that everything has to match between all the platforms is like, I mean, look, the entire tech business has tried this in so many ways. Like the whole like write once, run anywhere principle, like we've tried this so many times at so many levels. And it's either incredibly difficult or doesn't work every single time. And so the idea, I think the reality of the Mac is that it will always be second priority in Apple compared to iOS in terms of like software design resources and everything. It's always going to be a lower priority. It's always going to be more complicated in terms of what it has to cover. So I think what leadership should consider doing is scaling back the assumption that everything has to be done in unity with the Mac, and that applies to lots of things. You know, on the software side, that's a whole can of worms, but mainly on the interface side, this is where many of the sins have happened. The Mac doesn't need to match iPad OS or iOS in every possible way. In fact, the Mac needs to match those in very few ways, honestly, in terms of UI design. For Apple to continue to push iOS really hard, which makes sense. That's the competitive space. That's their big platform. Apple should aggressively push iOS forward. We can argue what forward means, but they should aggressively push iOS forward. The Mac is not that. The Mac is a mature, stable platform that they don't have or they don't choose to use the resources to aggressively push it forward. So they can either sloppily push it forward, which is the path they've sometimes chosen here, or they can scale back what they want the Mac to do in terms of like motion every year. Like, and so what John's saying, you know, you can do fewer software updates. That's one way to do that. Another way to do that is just don't have the Mac try to match the UI or the trends or the latest, you know, UI modifications of iPad OS and iOS. Have like respect the Mac as its own thing that has different needs, different priorities, and a very different level of resources, and properly allocate the tasks that you want the Mac to do every year in terms of updates and everything with the resources that you're going to give it so that it can be done well. And if that means doing less than iOS, which it almost always will, that's fine. We would rather have less done better than try to keep everything in perfect unison for no good reason, honestly, and have it be a sloppy mess on the Mac.
And by the way, I think even with a very small team with not many resources, maybe the amount they have now, maybe even less, if given something like a 2 to 3 year schedule,
that small team could do amazing things to the Mac if freed from the onerous strategy tax of, oh, you got, you know, by the way, we're having this big effort with the 26 OSs, and we all have to be on the same page here. Oh, we all have to add AI. We all have to do this. Those sort of Apple strategy taxes that are applied to the Mac drag that team down so much. If you just gave like that exact team or even a smaller team a multi-year runway to do what they thought was best for the Mac, without regard to whatever hell everyone else was doing, that would be great. And you're like, oh, they're going to bifurcate. It'll be too whatever. No, the other thing, which I think this team would understand, is that you just need a family resemblance in a line of products. They should all look like Apple products, but you don't need them to look the same. Like, it's very easy and possible to have a family resemblance between Apple OSs without them walking in lockstep about the design. Right? They can be offset by years. Like at various times in the Mac OS X, iOS, iPadOS era, there has been that family resemblance, despite not a single pixel being shared between any of those OSs. They all look like Apple OSs. They all looked roughly of the same era. But before the sort of iOSification infection started to happen to Mac OS, they were able to be themselves and all still looked Apple-ish and were sort of on their own schedule, right? Like, say someone decides to design, you know, iOS maybe is the leader and they come up with a new design look, and the Mac, you know, is inspired by that, and 2 years later it sort of updates to get that look too. That's fine. There's still a family resemblance there. Or even the reverse. Let's say that the Mac team working on a 2-year timeline comes up with a new look for Mac OS, and then the iOS people look over and say, hey, that's pretty cool. People seem to love it. Maybe we should, for the next big iOS redesign, maybe we should think about that. That kind of cross-pollinization is a good way to have a family resemblance of the product. So like an interface idea, the Mac comes up with some new interface idea and the iPad team looks at it and says, hey, that's a good idea. I think in the next version of, maybe the next version of iPad OS, we can do that thing that they just did on Mac OS because Mac users really seem to like it. And we think it would work on iPad size screens. Like, that's a healthy exchange of ideas. What is not healthy is I've come up with liquid glass and all our OSs need to take it whether they want it or not. Or, I think every app should look like, should only have the features that the iOS version does. So take all the Mac versions, remove half their features, and now they look just like the iOS ones. Isn't that great? Doesn't everybody love it? No. So anyway, all I'm saying is I don't think it's like, oh, there's just not enough. The amount of resources that are on the Mac now are probably more than they were in the supposed heyday of Mac OS X, right? Small teams can do amazing things if given reasonable schedules and if not put upon by a larger corporate strategy tax. And that's something you've always heard from the teams at Apple. It's like they don't have time to do what they think they should do for their product because they have to implement the important feature of the year that is going across all the platforms.
Tom Armstrong writes, what, if any, impact do you think Alan Dye's departure will have on the rumored touchscreen MacBook Pro expected to release in Q3 or Q4 2026? Will having a more orthodox head of design who actually understands UI UX result in a rethink of this project, or are those decisions beyond Stephen LeMay's control, and he's just got to design the best fridge toaster hybrid interface that he can?
Well, it's too late for that. For the touch, you know, touch-based Macs coming in 2026, that's done. Whatever's going to be done for that touch has been done. And, you know, it's nothing Steve LeMay can do to really change that at this point, except for perhaps minor tweaks.
And by the way, I don't think the liquid glass design is required for touch MacBooks to be a thing.
It doesn't help, it doesn't hurt. It's just kind of, it is neutral with respect to touch on the Mac, I believe.
Yeah. And as we talked about when we talked about that rumor of touch on the Mac, I think most of the value of touch on the Mac is scrolling and panning and zooming.
And using iPad apps.
Yeah, and using iPad apps. But like that's like what most people want touch on their laptops for usually is just like pinching to zoom on something on their screen or something like that.
Or
like
dismissing a dialogue, whatever. Yeah,
yeah, like that. I think that kind of stuff is going to work pretty well regardless. Like to make Mac OS really touch friendly, beyond that level would require effectively designing it into iPad OS, like radical.
Yeah, like, and you wouldn't want that because you'd be losing. Like the Mac is the platform where you have precise pointing, and lots of applications are only possible with precise pointing, and they run on the Mac.
Exactly. Like the amount of radical redesigning on the Mac to be required to turn it into a really good like touch OS, the metrics, the sizing of every control would have to change. The spacing of everything would have to change. The height, the thickness, even the font sizes, like so much stuff would have to change. That would be radically, broadly destructive to the Mac. And I don't, not only do I not think it's a good idea, But I also, again, we were just talking about like the resources the Mac is given. I don't think Apple would invest that much into the Mac to change that much for gains that I don't think anybody's really necessarily asking for.
Yeah. So the answer to the question is Steve LeMay is not going to have any real effect on the Touch Macs, unless there was some really terrible decision that Alan Dye was insisting on that's easy to undo. But, you know, we'll never know if that's the case.
Finally, Nate writes, what are your favorite macOS styles? Liquid Glass, the flat iOS 7 modern look, the glossy Lion Mavericks, end of an era vibe, early pinstripe, or even pre-OS X 10.
Wow.
Easy, easy. I call myself. For me, since I got my first MacBook around Mountain Lion / Mavericks, I still have a soft spot for the glossy look. And I was going through Stephen Hackett's incredible screenshot library, which I will try to remember to link in the show notes. And I think I came to the Mac at Tiger or thereabouts, and so that does have a special place in my heart. But as I quickly scroll through the different releases, I think Lion might be my favorite because it was still kind of the old, by my standards, kind of fun Aqua-y, but not as like clearly dated as Aqua. So I think Lion might be my personal favorite. That being said, I actually, in a lot of ways, from a visual perspective, kind of like Tahoe. I really do.
What?
I think
after
looks...
all of that,
you know, aesthetics are a matter of taste. Like, they're how it looks and how it works are two separate things.
Exactly. Thank you.
I personally think it's very ugly, but I can understand some people liking how it looks, despite the fact that it obscures the UI by putting blurry text underneath clear text and all that.
That's the thing, is that a lot of the functional aspects I think are trash, but I think aesthetically it looks fresh and new, and fresh and new is fun to me. But if I had to pick just one, I'd probably pick Lion. Marco, what would you choose?
Honestly, I don't have a strong opinion here. You know, when I look back, I also started using the Mac, I believe, in
it's
Tiger.
It's not just Mac, by the way. They asked about iOS as well. They're like, what's your favorite? Well, I guess it is. What are your favorite macOS styles? But then they mentioned the iOS 7 look. So anyway, go on.
I believe I started using it in Panther. And I upgraded to Tiger on that same PowerMac G4 or PowerBook G4, excuse me. But when I look at screenshots of Panther, it's very nostalgic for me. It's like, oh, that was my first Mac. Like, it was great. But, of course, it looks old by today's standards. So, you know, I recognize that. And to be clear also, when I'm criticizing the 26 redesigns, I'm not saying that the previous redesign should just be brought back, you know, just revert back, and that's the best thing. No, we should move over time. We should change over time. And there are things about the 26 OSs that do look nice. I don't think maybe any of them are on the Mac, but there are things about the other 26 OSs that look nice visually. So I'm not saying that like the old ones were better. I'm not saying the old ones are what we should go to, which is definitely not the case. But I do like a lot of the old ones. I do have a lot of nostalgia for like the Panther and Tiger era. And even just going like when I look back, you know, 5 or 6 years, you know, you look back at like, you know, like High Sierra or something, you know, like when you see these kind of interfaces, like, oh yeah, a lot of that is just what the Mac looks like with little tweaks over time. You know, maybe a gradient gets a little bit more solid, or a pinstripe goes away, or, you know, like a spacing gets adjusted a little bit on some icons, or like the icons change. Like, I like a lot of these things, so I don't really have a strong opinion on that. As for iOS, I think, again, like when I was designing for 26 all summer, when I would go back to my iOS 18 devices, it would look old. So I recognize, like, okay, this new one does look new and fresh. In some ways, I like some of the 26 elements on iOS, but I think I think everything that involves a blur is a mistake. Like, I think there's a lot you can take from 26 that is good. That's like some of, like, you know, the icon shapes and some of the designs and of the buttons here and there. Like, they look cool, but every single time a blur is used, I think that's a failure, and it does not hold up in practice. So that's like the way bars are handled, the way scrolling content goes under them, the way buttons are handled when they are floated on top of content. Anytime there's a blur, it's a failure. But setting aside that, when I look at, like, you know, past iOSs, I mentioned earlier, I think there was a really good era from like the iOS 12 to 15-ish era where the design was in a really good place. It was a very good evolution of what it was trying to be from iOS 7, but like better and evolved and refined. And you know, I hope to get back to that in the next few years. And I'm optimistic that I'm pretty sure. I think Apple can do that realistically. I don't know that they will, but they can, and I hope they do.
John,
so the only ones that I could say that I could pinpoint a particular look than say that OS sort of had its act together and was really good as a piece are two. One is my nostalgic favorite, which is System 7, which was the most important operating system release of my childhood. I think System 7, in hindsight, is not as coherent as it could have been because there was a lot of the legacy of System 6 in it, and the sort of upgrade from black and white to color that happened in System 6 came to fruition in System 7, but System 7 was pretty good. It had a little bit of a System 6 hangover, but I think it was pretty good. The Mac OS 8 Copeland style, Aaron style, you know, Mac OS 8 through the end of 9, the sort of that platinum look. I don't know which OS you want to pick out because they didn't really change that much, but anywhere from like, you know, beginning with Mac OS 8 all the way till the end of classic Mac OS, that look was extremely coherent and consistent. I think that is probably my favorite sort of, you know, they got everything right. The folders, the window Chrome, the menus, the font choices. There were some bad font choices in there too. You used to be able to change the font to Mac OS. So you could even do it in Mac OS 10 for a little while anyway. But like that look, that sort of platinum Mac OS 8 style, Copeland style look, that was very coherent and solid. So that's probably my single favorite. If you look at the Mac OS 10 era and on, since I did reviews of all those in the early days, every one of those OSs had something about it that I thought was awesome and something about it that I thought was worse than its predecessor. Like, they would always mess something. Look at my reviews. I spent 15 years doing these reviews. It's not like there was ever a version of like, oh, 10.7 is the one that got everything right. Nope. Like, every single one of those OSs is like, oh, this looks really good and this looks really clean and nice and they improved this. But look what they did over here. They made these icons worse. The tabs look dumb. They changed the toolbar icons again and they're worse. Like, there was never one where they got everything right. And it just got even, like, it became a real sort of clown show somewhere actually around like the 10.7-ish era. It was like where they started to get the iOS stuff thrown in. It was like, what are they doing? Like, they made these things cleaner and better and they refined these, but this other area, they went off in a weird new direction. I mean, whether it's the stitched leather on their applications or when they decided the sidebar should invade the toolbar, and that the legacy of that decision that has rippled through the history and we're still dealing with up to today's floating Tahoe one, there's no OS in like the Mac OS X era that got everything, got its act together to the degree that Mac OS 8 and that look did, or even probably the System 7 era. Now, that said, I did like around Yosemite, like 10.10, that was probably one of the stronger looks before, like Yosemite El Cap, like basically just before the sidebar cut into the toolbar and really screwed up all of those good ideas. Like the sidebar cut into the toolbar in Big Sur, basically. Right before Big Sur, those few OSs mostly had their act together. I am a little bit disappointed that like they drained the color out of the sidebar icons and like Finder and stuff pretty early on. Like I think 10.7 they did that. So if I had to sort of like design your own like look for like a future Mac OS, take all the good ideas of the past, it would be like, let the title bar be the title bar, kick the sidebar out of there, clear distinction between UI and controls. Don't make literally every single icon in the UI be a template image that's monochrome. Like, I understand why they did that, and I like a lot of it, but it really takes a lot of the fun out of it when that's just like the way every single app is, right? I think it would have to be some kind of hybrid of all the different looks. So I think the only two clean wins are System 7 and the Mac OS 8 look, and then the Mac OS 10 era. There's lots of OSs I liked parts of. But never, never since 10.0 has there been an OS where every single aspect of it, I said, they finally got it all together, which has been fun. Like, I enjoyed, like, the ride from 10.0 to, like, 10. whatever I stopped at in my reviews. because that made it interesting to see, like, oh, they're refining, they're changing, they're doing this stuff. Oh, but in this area, they made it worse. And then the next OS, they would fix that, but then they would do something else. Tahoe is just bad. They made everything worse, right? So it's not, Tahoe is its own special snowflake. So definitely not Tahoe. But yeah, I would say, like, probably, I think, where things really started to go wrong is when the sidebar took the toolbar. Not because that one mistake was so egregious, but because it's emblematic of a thought process that shows a lack of care for good UI.
All right, that's it, right?
Mm-hmm.
All right, one moment. Let me load up this crazy overtime thing. All right. All right, thank you to our sponsors this episode, DeleteMe, Squarespace, and Zapier. And thanks to our members who support us directly. You can join us at atp.fm/join. One of the many perks of ATP membership is our weekly bonus topic called ATP Overtime. This week in Overtime, we're going to be talking about the first wireless headphones from Fender and featuring many replaceable components. That's kind of an interesting new take on it. We're going to talk about that in Overtime. So join us to listen, atp.fm/join. Thanks, everybody. We'll talk to you next week.
John, you're doing a migration of some sort?
Hang on a moment. I got to type something in, and I'll get with you in a second. Marco can entertain you.
Well, okay.
All right, cool. We can keep talking about the weather. I'm sure people love that.
Right?
All right, I did it. I'm fine. Sorry. Slight delay. We're done. Yeah, so I talked about on like a couple episodes ago about my migration of stuff to Cloudflare. It started out that I didn't want to keep renewing SSL certificates, so I had Cloudflare be the SSL terminator for my existing websites on my shared hosting. And then it turns out that they're going to change the rules for SSL certificates, so you have to renew them even more. So it was great that I did that. And then I think the last time I updated you guys on it, it was like, okay, well, actually, I've moved my hypercritical.co website entirely to Cloudflare instead of Cloudflare just being doing SSL termination. Actually, I moved all the data there as well, and it's hosted in their equivalent of an S3 bucket with this little tiny worker process in front of it. I think that's where I left off. This is the migration I'm talking about, which is like, you know, taking stuff that wasn't on Cloudflare and putting it on Cloudflare, kind of. But really, it's essentially a migration away from what I kept referring to as my crappy shared hosting plan. And I don't mean to be mean to my crappy shared hosting plan, because it's not actually crappy. Like I discussed using cPanel with it. The company is Namecheap, which is a name registrar that you can register names cheaply, right? But honestly, they are a really good implementation of what they are, which is like from an earlier time, back when cPanel was the interface of the day, they do everything. You can host a website there. You can host a static website. You can have a CGI bin. You can have a shell account. You can have email addresses. You can register names. You can do SSL certificates. Like, they do everything for not a lot of money. There's a reason I've been there. I meant to look up how long I've been there. I'm pretty sure I've been there for a decade or more. But the downside is, when I say shared hosting, it means that, like, yeah, I have a shell account on a machine that is shared by other people, and there's like one web server running, like Apache or Nginx or whatever, that serves things out of multiple accounts' home directories. And that means, like, I don't have my own dedicated stuff. It's not even, I think, even Casey, you have like, don't you have like a dedicated, well, you have a dedicated VM, I imagine. You have a dedicated VM for your websites?
Yeah, well, it's a Linode or Akamai Nanode. So, yes, it's a dedicated VM, as far as my understanding anyway, but it's the smallest, wimpiest, crappiest one they offer, which is $5 a month.
Yeah. So, I mean, you're, at the very least, you have some reserved amount of resources within your virtual machine that are yours. But, and obviously Cloudflare, its big thing is they have a CDN, and they have all these network abilities to block bots and denial of service attacks and all this stuff. Shared hostings don't have that, because this type of shared hosting account was from before that era. So that's why I've been considering migrate. I've meant to migrate off of it for years, but it's like, well, I just have everything there, and it's a lot of stuff, and it's built up over the years, so it's a pain to move. So I was doing it in steps of like, I got to do this SSL thing because it's untenable for me to, you know, I was paying for SSL certificates because that's how old things were. So I want my SSL certificates for free, and I don't want to have to deal with them, so Cloudflare will do all the renewals. And then I'm like, well, I could move my site there, so I would hypercritical.co there. But once I sort of started doing that, I'm like, well, now I have like some stuff at Namecheap and some stuff not. So I started looking at what I have over there. Like, Namecheap also provides email for like all the domains and stuff. So all my hypercritical.co email was hosted there, again, incredibly cheaply. I had other domains that like they technically have email boxes, but I would just forward them to my Gmail or whatever. But like I have stuff there. So I was like, you know, and also I was using Postmark. Is that the name of it? The same thing we use.
Yeah,
for
the email sending API.
Yeah. So I could send mail from, because I still use Gmail as my main Gmail email client. So I can send email from Gmail, so it legitimately looks like it's from hypercritical.co. And you do that, Postmark will do that for you. It'll, you set up the DKIM and SPF. Like, anyway, it's a bunch of technical crap, but the point is I was paying Postmark to do that. And then the actual email account for Critical.co was, you know, the inbox was landing at Namecheap, and I was actually going through MailRoute. It was a large bunch of stuff. So I'm like, you know, let me see about fixing that. And maybe it's because I was jealous of you two putting your Fastmail referral URLs in the show notes. So now I'm going to put a Fastmail referral URL in the show notes. And yet, no, they are not sponsoring this episode. This is not a sponsor, but in a referral URL, if you sign up for Fastmail through my thing, I get a kickback. All right. But anyway, I moved my email to Fastmail. I got rid of my postmark stuff. I got rid of the Namecheap stuff.
Stop. You are no longer at Gmail? You're not using Gmail for your email?
No, of course I'm using Gmail. Never going to leave Gmail.
Okay, so I'm sorry. I think I'm confused. So what is it Fastmail then?
All right. So before I was using Postmark to be able to send email legitimately from hypercritical.co and my other domains from Gmail. Now I'm using Fastmail to do the same thing.
So it's replaced Postmark.
Right. Before, when email arrived, it would land in my Namecheap, like the MX records would lead it through MailRoute into my Namecheap account. Now, when email gets sent to hypercritical.co, it lands in Fastmail, and then gets forwarded to Gmail. But you see what I'm saying? Like, I've replaced Namecheap, MailRoute, and Postmark with Fastmail. And I tried it as like a sort of a trial basis, and I tried it out, and I tried all the stuff. I'm like, yep, it does everything everybody said it does. It was so easy to set up. It's super fast. It's great. Hypercritical.co/Fastmail if you want to sign up and give me a referral bonus. I signed up for 3 years of Fastmail. Love it. I eliminated three vendors and replaced them with one for less money. Big win.
Nice.
So now I'm looking at what's left at Namecheap at this point. Well, I have like my main family website there and a bunch of other miscellaneous crap. Because again, Namecheap, like, you can set up an arbitrary number of sites. You just got to get the domains, and you just like, I had so much crap set up there. And the other thing I had running there was like a lot of cron jobs. Yes, cron jobs. And you'd be run through cron because it was a shell account. And I had cron jobs, like things I'd written in Perl, right? They're just some kind of cron job that gathers some information about my life or business and have just been running for years and years, right? And some of those cron jobs would put things into the document root for one of my websites that's hosted on Namecheap. And one of the reasons I never left is like, what am I going to do with all those cron jobs? Like, am I going to port those cron jobs somewhere else? And do I really want to transfer all of those files? Because I had like stuff like my iWeb websites. Remember iWeb? You guys don't remember iWeb.
Yeah.
You remember? Is that before your time? Anyway, iWeb was like a GUI website builder that Apple made for several years where you could like make like photo albums and blogs and stuff, and it would pull from your photo library. And we did that for years. Like when my kids were young, we did like blogs of like, you know, Alex's first birthday and Alex is 3 months old and our formal family portraits and like... All those were like shoved into direct, because Apple used to host those, and then eventually I just like took the static files and hosted them on my website. I have a whole legacy of stuff. Like, well, I can move the files, but I don't know what I want to do about the cron job. So I started tackling that. I started taking the static files and moving them to another sort of static hosted website in Cloudflare being run out of R2. I did take the time to try to fix some of the iWeb stuff. That work is still in progress because I thought I had done everything, but then I tried to play one of the movies on my phone and it wouldn't play. Like, I got them to play on my Mac in Safari and Chrome because I had to like sort of re-encode them, but I couldn't get them to play on my phone. I did take a slight diversion into trying to open up my old iMovie projects, because at a certain point my iMovie projects no longer were imported by the new version of iMovie. Like, they got orphaned. So I was running iMovie in a VM. I was like, whatever. First I tried Lion, but that was the wrong version. By the way, I had to find an old version of iMovie or whatever. Then I tried Snow Leopard, and that's the one that worked. But unfortunately, VMware does not provide video hardware acceleration for Snow Leopard. So when I tried to render the video in iMovie, no errors were thrown, but you get a black square for the whole movie. So that's not great. So I'm still working on that. I mean, these are mini DV video, like as in a mini DV cassettes, you know, from 2004, right? I still have the thing, but I have the .dv file. I have the raw .dv file, but I don't want the raw file. I want my edit. I made these cute little edited things of the kids, right? I'm still working on that. So I have the thumbnail size ones that will play on the Mac, but not on the iPhone. But anyway, I ported those things over. I ended up writing some rewrite rules to make a lot of the iWeb magic that used to happen on Apple server happen on mine. There's a bunch of broken images because they were hosted at me.com and they're just not there anymore and I don't have them, so I don't know what they were. But, you know, I worked on that. And then the cron jobs, I mean, it's just, I don't know, it's like a decade and a half of Perl scripts that do various things. And, you know, this is when I started thinking, all right, I don't want to port like 7, 8, 10 Perl scripts to a language that will run in Cloudflare workers. Cloudflare surprisingly will not run Perl scripts.
No.
Shocked.
But I said, you know, large language model technology was originally created for translating human languages, like translate French to English or whatever. Like, that's the origin of that technology. That's why they're called transformer models, or, well, maybe that's why. But they are called transformer models, and they were originally designed with an eye towards human language translation. They're actually pretty good at programming language translation, too. So I said, you know what? ChatGPT, Gemini, Claude, let me describe to you this Perl script. Can you translate this to JavaScript for me? Because I don't want to do it. It's not complicated. I know JavaScript, but just like you have to go through every API and go, I'm using this Perl module. What is the node equivalent? Can I get that module? Oh, there's 6 choices for the node module. Which one should I use? Like, it's just tedious, and then you got to test it all. So I let the LLM have a crack at it. It did a pretty good job. Minor fix-ups nice. I need to do. It's all code that I'm familiar with, and each of the scripts is not more than, I don't know, 2 or 3 pages of code or whatever. Mostly what they do is read some kind of data sources and then write out a JSON file somewhere or whatever, so it's not rocket science. It actually fits pretty well with Node. I ported all my cron jobs to Node.js.
Wow.
And wouldn't you know it, Cloudflare Worker has a place where you can run cron jobs down to being able to paste in, like, the little 5, you know, the 5 numbers at the front of cron jobs. Right? You just paste them in that format, and it's like, sure, we'll run that job for you.
That's pretty cool.
That is cool. I didn't know that. That is very slick.
So I'm like, okay, I've you know, and the reason I never did that year for years and years is like, who wants to rewrite that? But now I didn't have to rewrite it. Something, you know, the LLM did it for me, and I was feeling real good. And then I said, okay, but like, a lot of the JSON files written out by my cron jobs are in the format understood by the iPad application status board.
I was wondering if that's what this was all about. I should have said it quicker.
For people who don't know, status board was an application made by a great Mac software developer, Panic, where they you run it on the iPad, and you basically get a series of boards. And on each board, it's basically just a grid that fills up the screen of an iPad. And you can drag out little rectangles on the grid, and each one of the rectangles, you can say, I want you to show a graph by reading this JSON file or the CVS file. And they came up with their own format for the CVS and JSON files, and you can do line graphs and bar graphs and lists and dials and icons. And they used it in their office to show, like, here's our software projects, who's working on them, here's how they're going, here's how many open issues there are, here's the backlog in our customer service queue. That's what Panic was using it for. This is a great application in the Panic style. And if you're listening to this, you're like, so they made an iPad app that's basically a toy version of Grafana and Prometheus? Yeah, that's what they did. Why would you ever use that? Why wouldn't you just use Graphite, Grafana, Prometheus, or any of the other enterprise applications that do all this? Because I liked how status board looked, and because when I was originally using status board, I didn't know about those programs. I know about them now, and now I don't like them because I had to use them for years at work. And yes, they're open source and free, but hosting any of them is much more complicated. But here's the thing. Status board was discontinued in 2018.
Not recently.
And every year since then, I've been like, is this going to be the year that status board stops working? Because I have it on my iPad, and only on my iPad. It is only an iPad app. It doesn't even run on the phone, I believe. And it still runs in iPadOS 26, but barely. It's like every day I'm like, oh, is this going to, like, it's kind of like Candy Bar, which is an icon management application. I believe it was originally made by Icon Factory, but Panic had it for a while. And anyway, that's been discontinued as well. But recently I was able to convince Panic to release a version that will at least launch on modern macOS. And I still use it with a warning dialogue on it. But anyway, those JSON files can put out my cron chips. I'm looking at them in status board, but it always bothered me that I can only look at them on my iPad, which means that in practice, I generally only tend to look at them before I'm going to bed. And then if I find something that's wrong, I got to like leave my bed and go down and fix it. I was like, you know, I've always wanted to make a web app version of status board. They would read the same JSON files and have the same UI, but it would be a web app.
Oh, my.
And I thought, this is the perfect time to do something that I wanted to do for a while, which is to try out those coding agents that actually do things for you. I use LLMs for coding all the time, but I just paste things into a chatbot and see what they have to say. But
there are other tools where you don't do that, where you just say, here, you do it. You make the file. You rename things. You make the edits. You check into the Git repo, all that stuff. And so I decided to use Claude Code. And I've never used it previously because I don't have that thing anywhere near my code. But this is an empty directory. There's nothing in it. And so I wrote up a claude.md file, and I said, this is what status board is. It was this app by Panic. It reads these files in JSON format. Here's a screenshot of the app from my iPad. See in that screenshot, there's four graphs. Here are the JSON files and URLs that you can download that derive those four graphs. Here's Panic's documentation of the JSON format. Here's how the status board app works. I wrote basically a one-page little book report slash software spec, reminding me of the good old days of me being a software developer on a team where you had to describe functionality to other people. I described it to Claude, and I said, go for it, dude. And Claude churned for a while, and a few minutes later, I launched the application locally, and I had status board running in a web app.
That's incredible.
Oh, my God.
And that is so freaking cool.
And the thing is, was it perfect? No. It doesn't really have any idea about UI, and it's kind of like anytime you're talking to a human thing. Like, I had some experience with having, like, obviously new employees. When I've been a software manager, I've been a software team lead, I've had interns. But, like, interns and very new employees are very similar, where if you give them instructions, but you don't certain things you leave unsaid because you assume they'll know, but new employees and interns don't always know those things. Same thing with Claude Code. It didn't really, if I didn't say how or where some part of UI should be, it just picked someplace and it made bad choices. So I spent the next, you know, few rounds going back and forth saying, that add button shouldn't be over there. This should be centered. Why don't you make a hamburger menu in the upper left and put these items in it? And bug fixing, like one of the things that I feel like a human wouldn't have done is, the screen to edit one of the tiles where you say, like, this is the URL, these are the options, blah, blah, blah. It has a bunch of checkbox for, like, you know, do you want me to show dots? How thick should the lines be? Crap like that. When you edited a tile, you could change those options and save, and it would be fine. When you created a new tile, it ignored some of them. And a human wouldn't make that mistake, because a human would know, hey, that dialogue that is like the edit dialogue for a thing, you have to honor all the controls in it all the time. Not just when you're editing. Like, when you create, it's the same UI, create a new tile. Great, fill out this form. You got to actually honor the stuff that I enter there. So a couple things like that where I would go through the app and say, yeah, I don't think a human would make that mistake. And I was like, anyway. This entire thing is happening over the course of one morning. I woke up in the morning with an empty folder. By the time I ate lunch, I had status board running on the web, to my satisfaction, reading all my old JSON files, which are now being generated by Cloudflare things.
That is so freaking wild.
Amazing. Totally amazing. All credit to... I'm not going to release this, by the way, because it's 100% a ripoff of status board. I even called it status board. Like, I used the colors. I used the status board icon. It took me longer to extract the status board icon from the iPad app, from my iPad, and edit it into a transparent Mac style icon or whatever that I could put on my web app. That took me longer than it took to write the entire web app. for Claude Code to write the entire web app.
Gracious.
Now I do have to say that the next morning when I woke up and woke my Mac from sleep, the entire directory containing my Git repo was gone.
Oh, that's fun.
I don't know who to blame this on. Obviously it was still in Git, so who cares? Like, it was on GitHub. I just pulled the repo back down. I didn't lose any unsafe changes. A little bit scary. Just like the whole directory was gone. The only thing I could do was look in Dropbox, but unfortunately I don't run Dropbox all the time. So when I launched Dropbox, it simply registered that the directory wasn't there and then registered the deletion as happening at like 8:30 a.m.
Oh,
that's
God.
Not when the deletion actually happened, I think, because that's just when I launched Dropbox. But anyway, I just did a Git pull. I could have restored it from Dropbox too, but I just did a Git pull and pulled the thing back down. All right. And then since I had been using Claude Code, and by the way, one of the reasons I stopped shortly afternoon on the thing was I ran out of tokens with Claude Code because I don't have the fancy version where you pay $100 or whatever. I don't have that many tokens to do things. So I ran out of tokens and I was like, I should stop tweaking this application. It's fine. And in practice, I didn't end up tweaking it all after that. But I was looking for other things to do with this. So I had two other ideas. One, now that I had this cool status board app, it's like, well, there's a board that I've wanted, and I wanted it recently because Marco has been changing up his little, like, end of the show pitch thing. I don't know. I don't
Marco, start your end of the show thing. How does it go? Thanks to our sponsors.
Thanks to our sponsors this episode, Squarespace, yeah. Delete Me, yeah. And Zapier.
And, right, and recently... He's been adding, recently, as in the past several months, he's been adding one of the features of, blah, blah, is overtime.
ATP overtime, our weekly bonus topic.
Right.
This week on overtime.
Yeah. You have been trying to characterize the length of the overtime segment in your spiel and going, oh, it's 15 to 20 minutes.
You never
quite
know
what to say. Because you're just going by the seat of the pants feel. I'm like, you know what?
That's my entire life, John.
Yeah. This is a perfect graph. This is a perfect graph for me to put in status board. So I wanted to... First, I have to do two things. One, I got to write a script in Node.js to get the data and write out JSON files. And two, I just paste those URLs in status board and go. So the script is really the thing. So I said, okay, Claude Code, here, you're up again. Now, this time, I have existing Node scripts. Like, I have actually written some scripts that aren't Perl scripts that generate these JSON files. Some of them, all the modern ones are written in Node already. So I already had a Node script that pretty much got all the data I wanted, except it wasn't getting overtime chapter links. And the thing about overtime chapter links is obviously they don't come from the public version of the show because overtime is only in the members version. So I needed the script to get the members version of the show, and then I needed it to know what the overtime segment was. And the second thing is I didn't just want to know the length of all the overtime segments. I wanted to see like a X number of episodes rolling average. You know what I mean? Because I don't care what like the lifetime average of overtime is. I just care, it's like, is it trending up? Is it trending down? What is the rolling average, right? So I took an existing Node.js script, and I ripped out the functionality that didn't need to be there, but left everything else. And I said, Claude Code, here's the script. I want you to leave everything as is, all the scaffolding about its logging and monitoring of the PID file and how it connects to the database and how it does this and how, leave all that. That's all good. Put a comment in it, said, you add your new functionality here. What I want you to do is pull the members-only version of the show using an authenticated S3-style client to get the episode out, parse the chapters, find the one that begins with overtime, get the length, add the data to a file, and then every time you run, just see if there's a new episode and add the data. And I want you to do two graphs, one that shows the overtime length of every episode, and two, show an N-episode rolling average. And it had real difficulty. It can make the entire status board in the morning, but it was doing this and it was like, it was just not quite getting it. Like, it was more complicated, surprisingly, especially when I said, you got to run in the dev environment where you're inside Docker and the passwords are all different and things are authenticated differently, but you also have to run in the production one where things are going to be different still. And it just kept messing it up. I spent an entire day on this, and by the time I was done, it was working, but I could have done it way faster. So there's two experiences there. One, it wrote in the entirety of status board in the morning. No way I could have done that fast. Mostly because I would have spent the whole time saying, what graph library should I use? Should I use the Canvas API directly? What should I do? Like, I don't have experience with the APIs it was using. But on this thing, a Node.js script that starts off 99% with code that I wrote, 100% with code that I wrote starting off, and then I just want you to add like 10%, I could have done it so much faster. And this is very much like the experience of having new employees or interns where, yeah, you could just do something so much faster, but the whole point is you're supposed to be, you're mentoring somebody, you're bringing them up to be from a junior developer to a more senior developer. So even though, yes, you could do it faster yourself, taking the time to write out a spec and explain how you want it to be done and having them try to do it and having them come back and say, no, you didn't do X, Y, and Z and go back and forth, like that process, when you're doing with a human, you feel like you are helping a human along their path to become better. When you're doing with an LLM, you feel like you're just wasting your time. So two very different experiences. One was a huge time saver, amazing results. The other one was, I should have just done it myself because it would have been a lot faster. But hey, I felt like, I'm doing it as content for the show and experience with these models. Number three, one last one. This is all happening during this week, by the way. This is like 3 days this week. I said, you know what? There's another project that I wanted to do for a while that I've never bothered doing because it's just got a bunch of annoying busy work and like looking up what libraries to use, and it just seems like too much of a pain. But now I've got a whole fresh days with the tokens. Woke up in the morning, right? I'm going to have a crack at it. And the project was passkey login to ATP.fm.
Oh, my God.
Ooh.
Which that's amazing.
Would be easy if our site wasn't written in PHP, which is not the most modern language with the most modern access to the most modern libraries. Do those two things go together, PHP and passkeys, two things separated by decades, literal decades? That's part of, like, I looked into it a bunch of times before. I'm like,
I could do this, but it just doesn't seem fun, and I'm not sure I'm going to pick the right library. And a lot of it is like, oh, you got to use the Zend framework. I'm like, I'm using the Marco framework, man. I'm not using like whatever thing. Like, they all wanted to plug into some kind of like, here's what all the modern PHP stuff uses. I don't have any of that. Yeah, I don't.
We
want
don't use
any
Composer. We don't use a framework. Like all
right,
these different.
Like, so all of like the guides for like how do you do passkeys in PHP? It's like, that's not going to work for me. But I'm like, you know what, Claude Code, you're up. So this is the first time I'm putting Claude Code not in an empty directory, not in a directory with a single file that I made, but I'm pointing it to the directory for like the repo that holds the code that Marco wrote that runs adp.fm. I'm doing it in a Docker container. It's all safe. It's all cardoned off or whatever. And I have stern instructions never ever to commit to Git and, you know, all this other stuff. But the point is it's all in Docker using local everything, right? And it makes a run at it. I read a big document. I explained at great length, look, here's the system we've got, right? Here's how things work. Here's where our data is. Here how, you know, you're running inside Docker when you're in dev, just FYI. And here's where the things are. And blah, I do the whole spec, talking to Claude Code. I sick it on it. It goes. It says, great, it's ready. Go do it. I go to the page to try to create a passkey for my account, which luckily the page does load. Creation of the passkey totally doesn't work. I spend a little bit of time going back and forth with like, here's the error, it's not working. Like, I'm not diving into the code at this point. I'm just saying, like, let's see what you can do. Because Claude Code can fix its own mistakes a lot of the time. But I was going back and forth for basically the entirety of a morning, and just absolutely nothing worked. It was just error after error after error after error. So I had some lunch, came back, dove in myself to try to fix what it was doing. Together, we started making forward progress. I also started asking other LLMs, like my ChatGPT or my Gemini window, so I wouldn't burn flog tokens for things, you know, just sort of manually fix stuff. But by the end of the day, I eventually got it to work. And I do think this was actually probably net-net a time saver. Maybe. I think if I had known what to do, I could have done it faster than Claude Code. But the point is, Claude Code pointed me in the right direction by finding a good library and essentially, you know, how I integrate this library into the existing code in a way that is doesn't require massively restructuring stuff. But it just got so many things wrong that I just had to go in and be like, I'll look up the documentation. That's not the arguments this function takes. I will fix it for you. Like, whatever. ATP.fm now supports passkeys. So if you don't like the thing where it emails you a login link, you can add a password to your account, which I added myself ages ago. Or you can also add a passkey to your account, and you can log in with the passkey. And if I screwed up the passkey implementation, blame me and Claude, but effectively blame me because I'm Claude's boss. But I'm pretty sure everything works as expected. So if you want to use passkeys with ATP.fm, you can do that now.
Wow.
This was a journey.
Nothing is left on Namecheap. I have canceled my Namecheap renewal. Everything I had on Namecheap is gone. I am fully on Cloudflare and Fastmail.
This was a journey, John, that I was not prepared for.
Neither was I. It just kind of snowballed all of a sudden. I just did a long Rectifs episode because, as coincidentally, Merlin also discovered, or not discovered, but started using Claude Code this week. Very coincidentally, he also did some status boardy thing. For a second, I thought, did you reimplement status board with Claude Code? He didn't, but he was doing some status board related. Some stuff that is similar to status board. The upcoming Rectifs episode will tell you. But anyway, I'm not sure if this is an endorsement of Claude Code. You do have to pay for like the $20 a month plan at least to do what I did. That's only good for like, I don't know, less than a morning's worth of tokens before you have to wait 12 hours for them to refresh. But I'm taking the win. I think it saved me a lot of time porting my scripts. It did the status board thing way faster than I would have. And the other two projects, one was a real disaster and one was mixed. So, you know, all I can say is in 5 to 10 years, this stuff is just only going to get better. And I think it's already extremely useful.
Yeah. That's amazing.
That's incredible. Cool. Well, that's
someone in the
chat
room asked whether I'm using the best model, Opus 4.5. I was with Thinking On, yes.
I'm speechless.
Did you add a passkey to your account? Did you try it?
I didn't know we could.
Yeah, I don't think
just go to go to your member page, and at the top it says you can add a password or you can add a passkey, and if it doesn't work, let me know, and me and Claude will fix it tomorrow.
Cool.
Wow.
Oh, and by the way, for the overtime thing, I forgot to tell you, the average all-time average length of the overtime segment on our show, it's quite highly variable, but the average is 21.78 minutes. The rolling 8-episode average is 25.6 minutes. So for your future end-of-the-show things, if you want to say it's about 20 to 25 minutes, or if you just want to say it's about 25 minutes, that
it's
will be accurate.
It's about 25.6 minutes.
If you ever want an updated stat, I can tell you.
It rolls right off the tongue.
It's about 20 minutes. But the problem is it's highly variable. Like our longest one, I believe, is like 45 or 46 minutes. And we have some that are like 15. So,
yeah, like the reason I say 15 to 20 is like I don't want somebody to think they're paying for 20 minutes of content and they see one that's 15 and they're disappointed. So yeah, I like
they
to under
45 and they're also disappointed. So, you know, it's highly variable. But anyway, I did actually want to know what the numbers are. I'll put in Slack the graph so you can see what they look like. But anyone could do this, really.
Wow.
Incredible. Titles.
All right, titles. I think my favorite might be Open Retrieve Expand Load.
That is good.
What was that from?
That your description of consistent titles of menu items. Like if the open command was different.
I don't know if we ever said that sequence. I think
you said it exactly like that.
I couldn't think of any... I think Casey came up with load, but yeah, open retrieve expand load is fine. I don't know if I actually said that, but
Casey did come up with load, but then you said it, and so if I delete Casey saying load, it's a clean flow of just you saying it.
Yeah. All right, let's see what else we have.
You had a lot of really good ones in the post show.
System 6 hangover. Yeah. Have either you two used that? One of the suggestions, actually, my wife suggested this, is like we could do a member special where we talk about this, but I didn't know if either one of you two would actually use Claude Code.
I've used Claude in chatbot form. I have not used Claude Code.
Same.
If you two haven't used it, I highly suggest that when you come upon some project, it's like a clean sheet little thing where you want to do it, give it a try. Like, you don't pick a big project. Just pick something small, like re-implementing status board as a web app. but it is a good exercise. If you have any experience writing specs for people, it helps a lot because you're writing a spec for it. But try it out. I didn't get to talk at all about the UI for it. Maybe I'll talk about that more in a future episode, but I don't think we'll do a member special about it. But I think it would be a good future, like, after show or topic for one of you two to say that you had tried Claude Code or one of the similar tools and what you thought of it.
I'll have to see if I can come up with something, because I can think of some things that I'd like to happen in call sheet, but as far as cleaning.
Oh, yeah. No, I would definitely not dive in with, like, let it edit one of your apps. But I thought you'd actually used it already, Casey, to do the call sheet website thing.
That wasn't code. That was just chatbot stuff.
Right. You can do a lot of stuff with chatbots if you just, like, need a function written or something or whatever or modified. But I thought you had done it just because 100% Claude Code could have just done that entire site for you. If you had explained it in a way that was adequate for it to do it. And I don't know, this is just for the bootleg people, but like, you do have to know stuff. Like, you have to already know, how do you deploy things to Claude Code? How does Node.js work out? Like, you have to already know that to guide Claude in the right direction, mostly. And it really helps if you use technologies that are popular. If I was telling it even if I was telling it to write a Perl script, if I was telling it to write something in Pascal, if I was telling it, I'm saying to Merlin, if I was telling it to make a program that runs on VMS, on a VAX, I think it would be far less helpful. But if you wanted to make a Node.js app in JavaScript, there's a lot of examples out there, and so it does a good job. So, and in PHP, like I said, less so, maybe. Like, there's a lot of PHP out there, but it was kind of at sea with our code base. And so, you know, your mileage may vary. So all I'm saying is, if you have some little project that uses a common technology, especially if it's one that you don't really know, give it a try. I think we all have like free trials of like the $20 Claude Code thing because of Anthropic sponsorship of ATP. So try it before that trial runs out.
I should do that. Like I said, I just need to think of a clean room thing to do. But yeah,
you should have tons of them, because this is your little garage door light or your home assistant things and crap like that. I'm sure you come up with something. Marco could have written his entire Tides app with it, I'm sure.
Yeah, probably.
I haven't tried it with any Apple technologies or Swift stuff. I have no idea how well it does with that. I'm just doing, you know, web tech stuff that I know.
I do like, it's less fun, but onerous strategy tax I thought was good.
Yes, that's a little redundant.
That's my entire life, John, I thought was funny.
Yeah, I think Open Retrieve Expand Load is the best ATP-ish title.
Yeah.
Going in the robot. Give me 1 second. Do that. We normal schedule next week?
I believe. Let me double check.
As far as I know.
Yep. Yeah, I think so, yeah.
Oh, no, I forgot the trailing speaking head on the member special announcement. Got to fix that real quick. Whoopsie-doopsie. There we go. All right. All right. Goodbye, live people. Thank you for being live people. Please continue to be live people. And if you're getting 2 feet of snow, Godspeed.